Good morning and welcome to Saline County's Board of Directors. The date is November 19th, 2008. All five commissioners are present, constituting a quorum. And welcome to everyone, staff, visitors, other guests. And at the head table, we have our lead attorney, Eric, Rebecca, the clerk of the board, and Steve Wright, our general manager, and the other four commissioners. So with that being said, if you have a cell phone, please have it in a position that's not going to disrupt the meeting. And if you're a visitor or an employee and you utilize the microphone, understanding that our sessions are recorded, please state your name. If you're a guest, your address, and then we'll give you a reasonable length of time. With that being said, let's open our meeting with a Pledge of Allegiance and a Safety Minute by Vicki Nordentop.
Good morning. Please join me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning. I'm Vicki Nordentoft. I'm the administrative assistant for the Security Department, and my safety minute today will be on badges. I want you to know that our new badges. We have successfully badged 800 employees and 600 contractors. Wow. And currently, we are online at Chelan Falls Powerhouse, at Rocky Reach, and Rock Island. And the good news is, we're next by the end of December. You could be seeing some new badge readers showing up here, and they operate a little bit differently, so I wanted to tell you what to expect. So you know it's going to be by the end of the year that things are starting to change, but right now when we look at a badge reader and we present our badge, you kind of high-five it on there, and you'll see a green light, and get a little tone, and you get access. Well, our new badge readers have buttons on them. Their tone is a little bit different. So we're going to have to use our badges just a little bit differently. And I think that this is a safety and a security issue, because if you're outside in the cold weather or your arms are filled with things and you're trying to come in, or maybe you feel unsafe and you need to run into our building, if you high-five your badge onto our new badge readers, it's going to put it into pin mode. It has little silver buttons, and if you touch one of those buttons, it's going to say, oh, okay, I need the next series of numbers. And you can't get in for like 10 seconds. And the wind is blowing, right? And your arms are full. So I just wanted you to know that in our new badge readers, you just have to hover. Just hover over the badge reader. And if you do accidentally touch the buttons and it locks you out, it'll be for those 10 seconds. So what you need to do to clear it is hit the hashtag button. So three simple H's: hover, don't high five, and hashtag, to get the free up the system. Other than that, I wish you a happy Thanksgiving and wonder if you have any questions.
A totally off the wall question that you just brought to my mind with your presentation. By the way, thank you for the presentation. It was great.
You're welcome.
But how did the pound sign get renamed the hashtag symbol?
Exactly. And then, I learned this. my kid taught me that, but I don't know where they got that.
Oh, okay.
But it seemed to go with the H thing.
Okay.
Hover, don't, high five, and hashtag.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's probably how Kleenex or tissue became Kleenex, or Kleenex became tissue, just public use, I would guess.
Thank you.
And that's pure speculation. Okay, taking a look at the agenda, commissioners, what are your thoughts?
Per the recommendation of management, I'd like to suggest that we move resolutions 14 and 15 to the consent agenda.
Second.
Okay, been moved and seconded to move resolutions 14 and 15 to the consent agenda. With that being said, any discussion? Are there any further corrections or deletions or additions? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. Motion is carried. Item three, CPO winners, and we'll have General Manager Steve Wright introduce that.
Yeah, I want to invite Casey Hall and Mark Heppner to come up to the table if they could. So normally we only have one winner a month of the cycle of personal ownership. People have shown a great job of taking personal accountability and improving the district's operations. This month we had two that were so good we couldn't help ourselves. We decided that we were going to go with two. So both Casey and Mark, I think, have done really extraordinary things. Casey, with respect to using information technology to improve our efficiency and effectiveness, and I hope he's going to take a moment to describe the project that he worked on. And Mark, in terms of using our Stop Work Authority and creating a more safe work environment for our employees, and then going beyond that in terms of his follow-through on the specific issue that he was addressing. So I didn't get a chance to talk to Mark in advance. The warning that we give to everybody is you're not required to speak here, but if you would like to, you get the opportunity to describe the event that you were involved in. So, Casey, would you like to start for us?
Sure. So I felt like the district inspection and with our construction managers and inspectors is a little antiquated, and I felt like there is a better way of doing it, of getting the data from the field into our archives and records so that our project managers could actually use the data and see it. So I did some research and found a application that can be used on a phone or a tablet that our construction inspectors and construction managers can actually use in the field. So instead of having to go do their work during the day and write everything on a piece of paper and take photographs and then come back to the office and have to download that information into our network, sometimes with a USB drive or off the phone, or then they have to take all their notes and actually type them into Word, into a document. This does it all in the field. So you're actually talk to texting feature on your phone, talking about the work that's going on in the field, filling out the safety information, quality information on your phone, taking pictures with your phone, all that's done in the field. We eliminate that time of having to come back into the office and actually downloading that information, saving up our inspectors and construction managers probably an hour a day of time that they don't have to come in and download this information. And we found that there's a lot more data that we're getting now because folks can do this in the field. They're not having to go, oh gosh, I got to go back into the office and fill this stuff out. It's actually real time. And we can, as project managers, are notified when reports are finished, so we can, and they come into our email, so we can actually see them and see what happened through the day instead of having to dig through the U drive or the project file to find that information. So
that's great.
Great.
Very good. Time saving.
So Casey, do the inspectors then dictate preliminary reports and then come back to the office and then just clean that up?
Yeah, they can do that, or they can do it in the field too. So if they feel they need to go in and clean that up on their tablet or phone, they can still type on their phone or tablet. They can use the web-based app on a computer, but most of our guys don't do that. They finish it up in the field and then they sign the report and send it on their phone.
Cool.
Very cool.
Very good.
And I would say also more real-time information for our project managers too. So they can see issues that are arising even during the course of the day rather than pick them up a day or two later.
Yeah, that's something. This is updated throughout the day. So as a project manager, go on and look at it on the actual computer-based, web-based program, you see what's going on through the day because it continually updates. So if there's a problem in the field, hey, take a look at this. You can take a picture and see it on your device.
Thank you, Casey. Mark, would you care to share anything?
Yeah, I'm Mark Afner, Environmental Compliance Tech. Been with the district for a lot of years. I was a hydro mechanic, and now I take care of the hazardous waste, hazardous materials, lead, asbestos, PCBs, on and on. In August, went up to Chelan Falls to look at a job. We were going to have an asbestos abatement contractor up there. Just go up there for our people to help, because I've usually try to be on all the big setting up, you know, proper containments and whatnot. During that event, for walkthrough, seeing that the contractor was busting up some material that had not been tested, very suspect for asbestos, so shut the job down. Luckily, I was wrong. It was not asbestos. If it had been asbestos, we'd have still been dealing with that problem. It shut it down, got negative air machines up there right away. It was a very dusty environment, regardless if it was asbestos or not. Dust was not a, you know, was not a good thing as well. So, and was out of town, different trainings, ongoing investigation with LNI. Just kept communicating whether I was here or, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock at night, answering phone calls, questions. That was part of my job. Everything went well.
So despite the fact that asbestos was not found, it was an environment that needed to be improved, I would say, from a safety standpoint. And you know, we've encouraged our employees to have stop work authority, and we want to celebrate when they use it and use it appropriately. And this is really a great example of it being used in the right way.
That's very good. Thank you.
It is.
Thank you for doing
that. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
I could do one other thing. So we had Casey in visit with a senior team last week. Mark was unavailable then, so he did not get his coin and certificate. I wanted to give those to him now and just say thank you to both of them for the tremendous job that they've done.
Thank you, gentlemen. Quarterly Energy Resources Update, Steve Wright.
And ask Greg Carrington, Jan Gaspers, and Andrew Grissell to come up to give this quarterly report.
Greg Carrington, Managing Director of Energy Resources.
Janet Gaspers, Energy Planning and Trading Manager.
Andrew Grissell, Customer Energy Solutions.
So today we're going to provide you with our usual quarterly update. We're going to just highlight today the things that have changed since the last quarterly update. So key message points here is net wholesale revenues are up by about $10 million above budget, and we'll explain the reasons why it's up that high. Specified source energy sales are about $1.2 million higher than budget. And Andrew is going to be providing you with an overview of the energy efficiency programs to date, and in particular, the LED streetlights that are being replaced. And so you might be hearing from constituents out there about those. One thing that I added at the last quarterly update was a monitoring of major changes in the Western power market. You're going to be hearing under general manager items an update from Chad Bowman and others about the new reliability coordination that's going to be occurring. I think I sent around a letter that we got from Peak last time that's saying that they were going to be ending the reliability coordination services. Those services are now going to be picked up by CAISO. And so by October, November of next year, we should be joining CAISO as part of that service. And hopefully that transition will be smooth. One of the things that you should be aware of under the short-term markets is that once people have the RC services through CAISO, it's much easier to join the EIM. So I think one of the things that you'll be seeing as a result of many people joining the RC services, you'll see a lot more people evaluating the EIM. Even we are taking a look at the EIM and updating our analysis of that, because half of the tasks that you need to do in order to join the EIM are going to be done already, because we're joining the RC, the connection, the electrical connections that are necessary to do that.
So may I jump in here?
Well, yeah.
So we're still not happy with the governance. The governance of CAISO has not changed. We were hoping for a more regional governance. And it's not. They have not changed.
Yeah, so there's separate governance structures. One is set up for the RC structure versus the EIM versus kind of the RTO as a whole. And so from a reliability coordination perspective, They are setting it up so that there's more stakeholder input, and the next version of the governance issue is going to have to be with the EIM and CalISO as a whole. And Steve, I don't know if you wanted to add anything on to that.
Yeah, I would like to. So we are unhappy with the governance structure. And the fact of the matter is this is still an organization that's run by appointees of the California governor and confirmed by the California legislature. I think the question that we're struggling with is, in this particular case, we really had no choice. Everyone essentially west of the Rockies is going to the CAISO RC. And we have to have RC services. It's a requirement. You can't operate as a utility without reliability coordination services. So we have to join. The thing we've been having conversations with folks about is we're on a slippery slope here. And where is it that we draw the line on the slippery slope and say, no, this action is too far, moving this far into the institutional structure is too far? And I would say that this is going to be a hard conversation because there are a lot of people who want to move forward because the potential economic reliability benefits that are available by moving to a bigger market. And at the same time, there's a worry about, so when is it that you've crossed the line and you've entered into a structure that creates a substantial long-term risk as to who's in charge of that market? So very, very difficult conversation we'll be having over the course of the next year.
Feels horrible.
Doesn't feel good to me, I'm going to be honest.
You know, when you have no choice, no other options, mm-hmm. And we're not happy with the structure in the beginning, it's a really uncomfortable feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, if the Northwest was capable of developing their own RC services in their own market, then that would have been nice. But I think as a whole, we've worked in bilateral markets for such a long time that as these other markets get organized, the Northwest was left in a position of tagging along. And consequently, we're in the situation we are because of the fact that we weren't able to develop a regional market ourselves, and so consequently we're kind of forced to evaluate, do we continue our bilateral market or do we join others? And that's the situation we're in.
Are others, other than the Northwest folks, is anybody else applying pressure to change the governance structure?
Yeah, that it's a conversation throughout the Northwest and throughout California. That whole regionalization effort that was underway in California had a lot to do with the governance, and that was a heated debate at the time, but that didn't pass. So we're now back to what I consider to a few steps backwards, trying to get the regionalization. The one thing I do have to say, though, is that you know we monitor very closely all of the rules within the CalISO. We have people that are attending that. We coordinate with other utilities. I am receiving some positive feedback that CalISO is making some changes, like market mitigation is an example of that, where they're modifying their rules to be more receptive and more understanding of kind of the Northwest particular situation as well. So there is some movement from CalISO that is helpful to us, but you're right to be cautious and you're right to be leery of making sure that governance gets fixed in the right way. Particularly, you know, EIM, you know, it was 4% of the market, and the day-ahead market that they're proposing could be 40% of the daily trades that occur. So then it becomes even more significant when you get into 40% of the trades.
So we're not just accepting it and moving on. I mean, we're moving on, but we're not just accepting it. We're going to continue to.
I don't think Steve and I would just accept anything that was not, you know, thoroughly thought through, and that the Northwest had equal say. But we're trying to catch up, to be honest. I mean, we're in a situation that probably isn't the best in the world. So state carbon policies, once again, Washington State has proved that nobody is in favor of additional taxes. So the state carbon, you know, initiative 1631 was soundly defeated, I think, by 8 points, if I'm not mistaken. So again, but just be aware that there are a handful of new initiatives that are coming up with carbon. We're working with PGP, trying to come up with our best policies from a carbon perspective, and more will be reported in the future. So the only thing that changed on the load resource balance so far is that we executed a few deals out there in 2022 and 2023. So you'll see a couple of the green bars that are in there, which are block power sales. We've executed a few, but other than that, everything is the same as last time. And then that's demonstrated on the next graph that just shows you the long-term sales that we've done to date, and those have remained the same from last time as well.
So on that chart, you show in 2022 and 23 a bump in our available power. Is that as our generators rehab?
Yeah, that's exactly what the reason is. And then when Janet gets to the net wholesale revenue slide, I'm going to provide you with kind of an overview of kind of like some of the things we need to think about in the future. I'm going to make some recommended changes potentially to this presentation, and I'll explain why when we get to the net wholesale slide as well.
Thanks, Mike. So taking a look at the Columbia River flows, you can see that in the first half of the year we had well above normal flows, quite a bit above normal, but then starting in July we were below normal. And so kind of remember that for a slide, a couple from that one. Taking a look to this coming water year, this is the Grand Coulee January through July estimate. And currently we have 99% of normal. So it's still very early in the year and a lot can happen. Taking a look at the weather forecast, November through January on the left. You can tell that the precip looks like we're going to be a little bit drier than normal. On the right, temperatures might be a little bit warmer than normal. We also look at kind of what the Canadian forecasters are doing alongside what NOAA is predicting. And so on the left for precip, it's kind of equal chances of wetter, drier. On the right, it's red. And so it's looking like warmer than normal. So take a look at natural gas prices for Henry Hub. Prices since last time have risen about 23 cents per MMBTU. So the $3.22 looks pretty high for this graph. But if you take a kind of short-term graph, it's what fits in the little yellow box down here. And so $3.22 doesn't really look that high on a historical basis. Take a look at our flat mid-sea prices for wholesale electricity. 2018 is now $30.30. At budget, we were $22.76, so we're up roughly $7.50 since budget. Then if you kind of just take a look at that flat forward price curve, you could, so the black line is what we currently have. So as of about a week ago, and the budget is this dashed blue line. So you can see that July prices were and August prices were quite a bit higher than at budget. Then we actually had a big increase in October, and I'll talk about that in a couple more slides. So the October shift really has shifted Q3 prices, kind of, or the high summer prices really shifted that whole forward price curve for July and August out in the future. Take a look at net wholesale revenue. And so net wholesale revenue is down from our forecast, so 105 million versus 108, so we're down about 2.7 million. And so when I showed the slide on Columbia River flows, we were down about 10 to 17% on flows in July and August. Also, we had a large Chelan plant outage for the surge tank repair, and so we're down about 2.7 million on net wholesale revenue. Other items were quite a bit higher on specified source, up roughly $1.2 million, and then our Alcoa contract were up close to $10 million, and that's just due to really high daily prices in July and August. So overall, up about $8.7 million.
And this is where I wanted to pause real quickly, because I think one of the things that is hard to track is there's so many variables in here that affect net wholesale revenues, and it's becoming more and more complicated. So the things I want you to think about is the net wholesale revenues are now affected by net generation that's affected by stream flow and outages, the power prices themselves, how much we're getting paid for environmental attributes, how much we're getting paid for our flexible capacity of our hydro project. Then, as you know, load changes are occurring, and that is affecting the availability of energy resources that are there. And then finally, the last category that I had on here is contract optionality. I would use the Alcoa contract as an example of that, where we're out on the daily market selling things and being able to capture some of the value. There's other times that we charge scheduling fees for certain clients and certain contracts as well. So in the past, it seemed like we always said it was either prices or stream flow. And the thing I want you to be aware of is there's now 10 variables that are affecting the net wholesale revenue. So I'm working with our team to figure out the best way of presenting that so that you can see all of the variables that are occurring over time and that we can track them a little bit more efficiently than we have in the past. Okay, so I'll yet to come, but I'm thinking at Q1 of next year, I'll make a proposal on that. Okay.
Thanks, Greg. And last quarter, when we came to you, it was Q2 2018 update, which is this purple line, and so this quarter we're following the black line, so basically not too much change. We do have a little bit of change. That forward price curve actually increased. You can see it stepped up where we're not really hedged too tight, and then also we had an increase in our load growth forecast. Switching over to the Lakeland lake level. So due to that surge tank outage that we had late summer, early fall, we weren't able to draft down quite as hard as we normally do. So we're currently about 3 feet above the target curve. Switching to market info. So back on October 9th, there was a gas pipeline rupture near Prince George, BC. And we have a trading hub, Sumas Gas, that's kind of right on the Washington-Canadian border. And when price of gas at that Sumas plant goes up, our electricity prices also follow up. So you know, we had been seeing electricity prices here on NC in the 30s. We were in the low 100s on a couple of days after that. Prices are still higher. A gas pipeline is supposed to be repaired kind of mid-November, but we're kind of hearing it might not go to 100% capacity. They might still run it at some reduced capacity even after the repairs. Then over on the right, Southern California faces record natural gas prices. That earlier slide, we had Henry Hub at $3.30. So because of a bunch of supply constraints, hot temps, we saw gas at that City Gate Hub to be $39.31 per MMBTU. So super high gas prices means high electric prices.
Janet, would you pause for a second? I think this is significant, and I think it's worth commenting on for just a moment. So we've talked about how lots of wind and solar are coming in the market. Is a direct competitor for our product. It drives down the price of our product. We've seen that on the average energy prices. If you go back to that slide 14 for just a second, so we did see, we've also known that there is a problem if there's a shortage at any point because you don't have enough capacity on the system to be able to survive difficult circumstances. So in late July and August, you see lower hydro because the runoff came early this year. You see a substantial increase in gas prices, and you saw some hot temperatures. And so you saw very high prices. Well, the interesting thing about that is the market is now looking at that and saying, we are now wondering if that will happen every year into the future. So you see that spike in the market that occurs in that July-August timeframe. There are good fundamentals as to why that should happen, but the fact of the matter is we don't really know yet. for sure. Mm-hmm. But we do have always had an expectation that the big supply of variable energy resources would drive down prices on average, but there would be these periods in which that you would have spikes in prices. And you're beginning to show that in the market prices, the forward market prices that are as a result of what we saw this summer. So we'll see if it holds up or not, but this is generally fitting the pattern that we would have expected to happen with a lot of wind and solar on the system.
So this is good. So if we executed another slice, then it's probable that the folks that are out there bidding on our next slice would be taking a look at these curves as opposed to the blue curves and hopefully would get paid more as a result of that.
Thanks, Shannon.
What was the months, June and July?
July and August.
July and August.
When we saw the high price spikes this year.
And so doesn't coincide with good stream flow, though. August is low stream flow, right?
Yeah, and this year was, if you remember Jan's graph from earlier, was lower than average just because of the way the runoff came off.
Yeah.
But I do want to point out that it does correspond to high capacity. So when you have lower stream flow, when you're not running full out, you have the ability to go up or down on your hydro projects, and that flexible capacity is the thing that's most valuable. And that's the reasons why I was telling you that we needed to kind of re-look at what affects net wholesale revenues and look at the flexible capacity and the value we're starting to see associated with that.
And the highest prices were on those afternoon ramp hours. Mm-hmm.
Greg, I have a question. So is it the shortage of gas or is it the shortage of generating capacity?
Yes. it's both. I mean, it's all of the variables and California has been kind of riding on this. It's always going to be available from the Northwest bubble, and they've been able to pick up capacity in the market. And we've been sending a strong signal to California that you can't ride that wave forever because you're going to run into low flow situations where capacity is not available. So there was a time in September, I think it was in 2017, that they were actually 8,000 megawatts short on capacity and they were able to pick it up on the market. But you don't want to be 8,000 megawatts short on capacity and pick it up on the market and depend on that because you may be in a low flow, stream flow situation. They were just happened to have it available on the market and were able to grab it. So those types of situations are the reasons you start to see those spikes in the summertime.
I guess my question is, wouldn't it be logical that a gas generator would simply increase their generating capacity if they were aware of this chart?
So what you would, a gas, so it would have to be a gas peaker. It couldn't be a baseline project. So it would have to be, a single cycle unit that would be available and up and running. So they would need to. So they would be looking at this chart and doing exactly the same thing as long as carbon regulation didn't affect their ability to provide that at a reasonable cost, right?
Right.
So that's one of the concerns.
So the challenge is this ramp, this afternoon ramp, as the sun goes down, keeps getting bigger and bigger. So 15,000 megawatt ramp is a huge ramp. How do you get 15,000 megawatts sitting there, not operating, and then running within a couple of hours? So you can keep them spinning. You got to pay something to do that. Are they receiving enough money to do that? And more of these plants are being shut down, or they're not operating during the daytime, so they're not able to ramp. And that just drives that price up in the afternoon. Even if the gas is available, you may not have the capacity in order to be able to meet that afternoon ramp. So we're working with PGP on a study looking at the reliability impacts of going to these high levels of variable energy resources, and we're thinking that we're going to be bringing that to you sometime in the January-February timeframe to just describe what's going on in the West and how what these problems are that are occurring and how they will tend to drive prices. Ultimately.
Okay.
This was a chart just showing Henry Hub prices, which most all of the trading in IMAX is Henry Hub, and all of the smaller hubs like Sumas is a basis compared to Henry Hub. And so Sumas might have been trading Henry Hub minus a buck. On October 9th, you can see that Sumas, instead of Henry Hub minus a buck, it went like Henry Hub plus $5. So kind of a big difference.
Alberta Gas, but it's the Southern California purchase gas from Alberta. Or do we know?
Not very much.
Not very much.
It's a separate problem in Southern California. They have what's called Aliso Canyon, which is a storage facility, and mm-hmm. it started leaking a couple of years ago, so they had to shut it down. So they've lost a big storage resource. That's the primary driver of the big gas prices, the high gas okay. prices in California.
Switching gears a little bit over to our energy efficiency programs. This shows a summary of our savings as of Q3, and so end of September. Our two-year compliance is a reminder, two-year compliance target, we're looking at 2.4 average megawatts. Our annual stretch target, about 1.7, and we are well on our way to meeting both our two-year compliance as well as our stretch goal, and we expect to hit our stretch goal this year. You can see the incentives and labor costs, we're just over $2 million, and then as we look at that value over the life of those measures, we're looking at $3.3 million, and so we're providing some good return on that.
So, Andrew, do you recall how many megawatts you've been able to accumulate with the program?
Yes. We are, since we really started in about 2010, we're just shy of 20 average megawatts of energy efficiency that we've been able to acquire in the county.
So the one thing, you know, I know that we're looking at this and you're thinking, oh, 1 megawatt is nice. But the thing is that it accumulates over time, and so consequently, we're starting to get into the point where 20 megawatts is a lot of energy that I can then use, and we can sell a block product on the market. Once we get to 25, it's equal to one block product that we can go out and sell. So it's adding up to be substantial.
The average life of our measures are 15 to 16 years, and so that savings keeps, you know, until that first 15 years rolls off, you know, it's getting it's increasing at that rate. I also wanted to provide an update on our streetlight retrofit project. They began in October. We've been making good progress to date. We're approximately 25% completed. Leavenworth was completed in October. They've installed the Cobra heads in Cashmere. We still have the decorative lights to do in Cashmere. Lights in the rural areas from Lake Wenatchee to Monitor have been installed, as well as in the Manson and Chelan area. And then work within Chelan has started. And then also the Washington State Department of Transportation lights are nearly complete as well. And this is just our project schedule at this point. And we look to be complete towards the end of February. And the original scheduled completion date was the end of this year. We found an opportunity to do some additional work on our own light poles at the same time, which created an efficiency, but it increased the schedule of the project some, and so we took that advantage. We took advantage of that opportunity, and so that's where we're seeing the schedule coming in a little bit later. And so also wanted to let you know, if you do get contacts, I know that I've heard from a couple of you that have heard from our customers, and when that happens, we are trying to promote that they contact their, you know, city or county, you know, the party kind of responsible for their area. However, if they do need to talk to someone, they can call me. So you can let them contact me, and I will get a hold of them, and or our project manager, who's John Goodwill. And I can get that.
Or if it's the county commissioner, I'll contact you.
Right.
Right. Well, if it's a county commissioner and it's in their area, it's probably their light that we're replacing.
Right, exactly. Yes, and that's fine. We've taken some of those calls. We've been able to take care of all of that. All of the cities are doing punch lists, which are, you know, we go through, you know, it's a big project. It's a complicated project. Something gets missed here and there, but we're making sure that we keep track of everything and going and making it right. So.
I wonder how much our megawatt usage goes up when Leavenworth turns on all the lights all at the same time. We should probably take a look at that.
It's a lot less than it used to be.
Yeah, it's all LED.
Because we helped change those out.
Change those light bulbs, yeah.
So. Yeah, you go through there. You can tell they're all LED when you go through Leavenworth now.
Yeah. Project's going well, and like I said, get a customer contacts you. We will take care of it.
So this is the summary slide, which you saw at the beginning, and time to ask if you have any further questions. And as an action item, by Q1, I'll get back to you about how we may present some of that information a little bit differently that talk about all those variables in the future, which are we're trying to track down and sort through ourselves. Any other questions that you have?
I just continue to have good feedback on the lights, so people like them. And
appreciate hearing that.
I haven't had any complaints. Great.
Yeah, have you seen them? They're like definitely, I know he described them as a cobra, but they're like low profile. You kind of drive by them and wonder if the streetlight is missing, you know, because it's so small.
Yeah, our mayor in Cashmere was bragging about them at Rotary and suggesting people go out at night and look at certain areas of town that were already completed. So
yeah,
there's real ownership and pride.
Good.
All right, thank you.
Quarterly projects, contracts, and project revision.
Update. Dave Nelson.
Morning, commissioners. Dave Nelson, business advisor. And I've got a few reports to go over with you as part of the delegated authority. I'm just going to focus on the exceptions on these reports or the new items. The first one is the major active capital projects report. And as you see, there's a number of schedule variances noted by the red circles, the white X's in them, related to the Powerhouse 1 modernization projects. And as you're aware, from a board presentation on November 5th, we have realigned the schedules of all those projects to fit with what we think can be accomplished and the issues that we've been seeing there. And so these dates of expected finishes now tie into that updated schedule information. Next item is the North Shore Chelan substation. The schedule and cost variance was discussed with the board in the first and second quarters. That's not new information. And also the same for the Bavarian substation. Similarly was discussed with the board. The Rock Island Powerhouse 2 storage building schedule variance was discussed with the board in the first quarter report. And then on the next page, the North Mid-Sea Transmission Project, we have a cost variance that was presented to the board on November 5th. And that revision is included in the 2019 budget filing. The OMI substation cost variance, that was discussed with the board in the first and second quarter reports. Rock Island Powerhouse 2 bridge crane and gantry crane below it. We have also updated the schedules on those and revised the scope and costs associated with those. And that was presented to the board in a presentation on October 15th. And then the last item of note is the domestic water tower and piping for Rock Island Powerhouse 1 was completed and it's in service. So that'll be dropping off this report. The next report is the capital project budget revisions during the quarter. Just going to highlight a couple things here. If you look at the bottom of the page, it was $1.35 million in budget revisions or increases over the quarter. Most of the items you see are adjustments to a budget offset by another project budget. But if you look about just past halfway down in the blue, we had the Rocky Reach Visitor Center roof extension project that was a budget increase of $600,000. That is actually a project that will be in execution in 2019 and 2020, but we needed to establish the project now to allow it to go out to bid and get started with some of the procurement issues. Just below that, the Wenatchee Riverfront Park Canyon 2 drainage pipe for $495,000 project was added, and I think you're well aware of that situation and project. So those two were the significant adjustments during the quarter. And then the next report of the active contracts greater than $1 million. Up the top, we have two items notated in yellow, possible adjustments needed. Those are for Rock Island Powerhouse 1, B5, and B8 purchase contracts. We'll be continuing to update as we work with the contractor and finalizing the schedules of those. So we'll update the completion date of those needs to be adjusted. And about two-thirds down the page, we have the Strider Construction new bid associated with the Wenatchee-Shaston Wastewater Treatment Facility improvements. That was approved by resolution in August. And on the next page, we have two new task authorizations under a larger agreement with Superior Consulting for website asset planning and Rock Island B9 and B10 oil seal temperature data analysis. Just below that, we have another two-year Skaha hatchery rearing cycle contract with Okanagan Nation Aquatic Enterprises. And on the next page, we have five additional task authorizations underneath a peer technical agreement. Those are primary for inspection and project services. Below that, we have a contract that was approved under a bid under the delegated authority. That's why it's in orange. To Hearst Construction for the Rock Island Hydro Site Utility Improvements. That was awarded in July. And that's the last item on that report. Nothing on the last page. And then just to note that we had no negotiated contracts during the quarter. So there is not a report on that attached. That's what I had for you today. With any questions?
Thank you. Okay. Right, thank you very much. Rand Property Transaction.
So Dan Frazier is going to come up talk about this. Recall that we had entered into a term sheet agreement with the port to purchase the Horan property. Team has been working very hard and diligently to work through a whole bunch of issues, that many of which we did not anticipate when the term sheet was put together. And we have reached the end. And so Dan's going to report to where we are with that. Recall that this is not for action today, but we would anticipate bringing this back for action at the next board meeting. Dan?
Thanks, Steve. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services, and I'm up here representing a team that worked very hard over the last several months. Vicki Griffin from our real estate group, our real estate manager, and Karen Wiggum from our legal team. We spent an unmanageable amount of hours working on these agreements. We had no idea the complexity that would go into creating the 11 agreements that you're going to see over the next little bit from that term sheet. It sounded, hey, we got a deal, but it takes a lot of work to get to this point. So the team has worked really hard. So what I'm going to take you through today is a recap of the term sheet so we know where we started here. We're going to talk about some agreements that were already executed, one of which came to the board back in October. We'll talk about the remaining agreements that we'll be bringing forward at the next meeting. Then we'll talk about next steps and take questions. And at the end, there is one action item, which is the board can choose to set a surplus hearing for the next meeting if that is desirable for the board to do today. And so we have a draft motion for the board to set that hearing. So take you back. I was here on July 23rd, went through the term sheet, and that term sheet was really a package deal. And if you recall, the package was that all these things had to happen together if this deal was going to come off. So the high points of that, PUD was purchasing the Horan property, the 19-acre Horan property. It's three different parcels, which I'll show you in a minute. The port would purchase our Confluence Technology condo units, which there are two. The port would then lease back to the PUD the two units that we have in the building currently occupied, and also lease us a portion of Port Industrial Building Number 5. To make sure all these things had the ability to happen and give the board the opportunity to make decisions in the future, we also have options. One of the options was for if the board does not decide to utilize that property out there at Horan, we have the port has the ability to purchase that property back from us. We've established pricing. We've established a term for that. We'll kind of go through those issues. We also wanted to continue to partner with the port and the city in working through redevelopment of this property if we potentially move. And so we have a property option on this property and the Holly Street property. And then finally, the last option there was something that came up during this process, that the opportunity for us to utilize the IB5 building is great in the short term, but in the long term, that may be a piece of land that we would want to own, and it could develop at some later date in a manner that's less compatible with our use out there. So we exercise or are able to exercise an option if the port does desire to surplus that property, we would have the first right.
And that's the building right beside the property that we're talking about. Out there.
Absolutely. Yep. And I'll go through a map here in a second to orient everybody. The little pieces were the CTC video conference agreement, which is so we would be acquiring a 25% of the use in the video conference center. The high density load exception agreement, and that's really for the port to be able to continue their current uses in the building and their current tenancy, should the tenancy change. And finally, the interlocal with the city and the port and the PUD to work on this Fifth Street redevelopment planning process. So just to orient everybody on the properties themselves, the three parcels in red, the larger, we call the Haran block, is the larger one, and the 1 acre parcel to the very kind of east, the upper end of that. And then the kind of L-shaped parcel to the north or to the left there. So those three parcels are the 19 acres that comprise the property, which we would be acquiring from the port. The yellow outlined is the portion of the IB5 building that we are currently leasing. The blue around that parcel is the option property that we would have an option if the port does choose to surplus that anytime in the next 15 years. And then, of course, the green is the CTC, and our units are within that, units LL1 and 201. So the two executed agreements that we're currently working under, the temporary access agreement, and that allowed us to start our due diligence early. We knew it takes us quite a while to make sure that we've got everything in place, that we've done our environmental due diligence, our geotechnical due diligence, all those things. So we needed to get an early start. Normally, you start these after you've signed a purchase and sale agreement, and that's actually part of the agreement. But we wanted to get an early start, so we were able to execute this temporary access agreement back in August. And so we have that, and we've been using that quite a bit to do our work on both the RAM property and in the IB5 building. Then we brought a lease of the IB5 building to the board on October 1st, which we entered into a lease, and we're currently moving some of our functions into that building right now. So we're looking at some other opportunities in that building going forward also. That's a 4-year lease with a 2-1-year options on that.
Dan, we just leased part of that building.
Yeah, it's this. So if you see the yellow part, there's a little piece outside the yellow part there. That is actually Ultra Polymers leases that. Really good tenant to have next to us. We've made contact with them, and they don't have a lot of parking needs, and they don't have a lot of the other space needs, so they fit well with our use. So now on to the agreements which we've been working on. The first is that purchase and sale agreement on the Haran property itself. We would be purchasing this for 19 acres. At the term sheet time, the negotiated price was $10 a square foot as determined by a boundary survey. That survey has been completed as part of our due diligence. And so the agreed-upon price there, the total price is just under $8.3 million. We were able to negotiate 2 shares of irrigation water into that purchase, so we would be able to use irrigation from Wenatchee Reclamation on the site. And actually, those agreements, while they're not referenced in there, that's actually 2 more agreements we're just completing, which is a transfer water right transfer agreement. And the port operates, I'll use that term loosely, they've taken on the responsibility of operating a little irrigation system out there, and so we'd be agreeing to take our delivery through their irrigation system. But that's the only way to get that water to our site. The next one is the purchase and sale agreement for the actual condo units, LL1 and 201. The port will purchase those 2 units, and the lease back of those units to us was a condition of that sale. And this is the reason we would need to have a surplus hearing, because we would be surplusing those 2 units, and that requires board action and a public hearing to be held. So, as I said, the lease was a big part of that sale, and so this was the agreement that we probably spent the most time on. It's an interesting agreement because we currently own the property, and we need, because of our critical operations in that building, we need to almost be an owner still. And if any lease property before, you have different rights as a tenant than you do as an owner. But over the 15 years of the relationship in that building, we've executed maybe close to 20 agreements that have allowed us to use certain parts of the building, limited common elements, And we needed to preserve those rights as close to ownership as possible. So that's what really took a lot of time in going through each of those agreements, what parts survive, what parts do we still continue to enjoy our ability to act like an owner in the building while still giving the port an ownership. You know, they're buying them from us. So so that was a lot of nuance in that relationship and getting that on paper. I think we've reached a really good solution. And the port was great in understanding our needs and working through all this contract issue so we could be here today.
Understanding everything you just said, I'm thinking about part of the negotiated agreement is if we don't ever execute and use that the port has the option to buy the property back. On this purchase and sale for the units LL1 and 201, is the reverse also true?
It is not. It is not. We, through this process, as we got into the sale of the CTC, one of the decision points that we had to go through was, what is the long-term use of the CTC for us? And it really doesn't fit with some of the regulations that are coming our way, and they've actually been released, but we're not under the requirements of them yet. So we knew we would have to do something with our operations in that building. So it didn't make sense really to be able to go back. So the annual rent on that $350,000 plus a portion of the electricity and gas for the building, really our portion. And it's at the end of a four-year term, the rent increases for the last 2 years, the two option years. The video conference center, and that's a priority use agreement for the video conference center. So if you go in the CTC and go left, those four rooms that we frequently use for meetings, those are termed the video conference center. We would have 25% of the available time to those four rooms. And it is a nine-year agreement, but it doesn't start until January 1st of 2023. If the board chooses not to utilize the Haran property, there's an option to cancel this should we not need it, because we wouldn't be out in that area. One of the nice things about this is we've negotiated this priority use, which is our ability to schedule up to 12 months out. And we have a collaborative process to figure out if there are conflicts, how do we move things around. Being involved with the convention center for 11 years, those kind of things happen where you have somebody who comes in, they're here every, you know, the first week of June every year, but you have an opportunity for a big event to come in and they want, you know, most of the facility. So some flexibility in the contracting was good so that we can negotiate and make sure that video conference center is working for the port as well as working for us. And there is also a potential renewal option on that piece too. So then we get into the options, and the options are really those, what do we do going forward, and keeping the options open for the board to make decisions, and then also options for the port to help us in the economic development and the repurposing of our properties. So the port option to buy back the Haran property, there are three what we call triggering events. If we decide in open session that we are not going to use the Haran property, is triggering event one, they can purchase it back if we surplus it. If we don't actively develop the Haran property with 10 years, they can say, okay, your time's up. It's time for you to surplus it back to us. Or if we do develop the property but don't need all of it, they could take a piece back. So if we used 18 acres and there was an acre that they would like, they have the first option really on those parcels. And that would actually go for 20 years that they would have that ability to purchase that back. The second option is the option of the port or of the port to purchase a piece or all of the headquarters or Holly Street properties. These are, right now, there's over 15 parcels, I think, between the two sites. And so a portion is probably where you're going to see this develop. But is it a portion as it currently exists, or a portion as someone sees an opportunity? So they have an option to purchase. It is a market-based appraisal is how a price would be determined. And if the port is only wanting a portion, we have the ability to review that and make sure the remainder is still an economic remnant and something that we to hold on to or have another opportunity for someone else to purchase. This has a 15-year term that this option would exist. And so that really runs at least 10 years. If we do decide to move out to the old station area, there'd be at least 10 years for them to continue to have that option.
So Dan, I have a question. If, assuming we move forward and were to build a new headquarters building, and this facility was surplused. And a developer came along and said, well, I'm going to develop this into the best use for the city of Wenatchee. And that occurred with it before the 15 years was up. How would that obligation still run?
It would actually run with the port. The port does have that first option. The port being an economic development driver in the county, I think they would be right at the table with this developer, I would hope. I think that's the intent, is they would be the ones out there finding that developer. It doesn't mean they're going to develop it for their use. They may be partnering with someone to develop it for a broader use. It kind of depends on what the market is at that time.
So the understanding is that if a developer comes in and develops this, then that option, which runs for 15 years, is null.
Yeah, if we offer it for surplus and the port does not exercise that at the time of the offer, then the option goes away.
Okay.
So if we say we wanted to surplus this whole site, the port says, you know, it doesn't make sense for us right now, then whoever comes in is open.
Okay.
After that. Thank you. Correct. It's basically a first option. All right.
Can I ask one more question?
Absolutely.
And could you go back to the CTC Center discussion on the 25% lease of that time for us? Have we heard, are they going to continue with that video conferencing area in the same manner, or do we know how that's going to be used?
Our discussions, and the port is here today. If Jim Koontz and Pete Fraley are here from the port, we do have some questions for them. Our understanding at this point is that that portion at least will remain going forward. They are looking at their operation. They're adopting new policies actually this year still. There's some opportunity to change some things on the other wing, the mm-hmm. west wing, but the intent would be for that to be maintained in its current. If they were, after we enter this agreement, if they do want to make a change, they have to provide us 2 years notice so that we have an opportunity to find another place to use. That was one of the safeguards that we put in there. Okay. And then finally, that option to purchase the IB5, IB number 6 building. So if you recall back at that other picture, there's a portion of the building we're not using. There's also a small building that's currently a daycare. That they call IB6, so that parcel would include both of those buildings and the land under that parcel. And so that, again, would run the same as the Holly and HQ parcels, which would be a 15-year term and based on appraised value. Finally, the last two agreements are the HDL agreement, and this is the high-density load exception agreement. So this provides an exception to those high-density and crypto upfront charges that we're currently contemplating, some in place and some contemplation, and it applies to just the first 2 megawatts in the building, which is basically the current use. This gives the port the flexibility for if their current tenant leaves, they can bring another like tenant in without being subject to those upfront charges. And it runs 10 years. One of the complicating factors of this whole package of agreements was all the different terms. And so just last week, we decided we need to pull all these together. We spent quite a bit of time syncing up all these agreements. That they'll all start at closing and run for whatever period they have. We had some that at signing, some were at closing, some had date certain. So just those kind of things you can imagine with that many agreements, trying to sync all those things up. And the last one is the interlocal agreement for the Fifth Street redevelopment planning, and that's the three-party agreement with Chelan PUD, the port, and the city. And Alice Williams is here from the city if you have any questions in that area. And this is where we're going to be engaging a redevelopment consultant to help think through what's the best future use of this site, both the buildings and the site itself. This is something we're doing in conjunction with the Downtown Association and the Chamber of Commerce, and they're both key stakeholders in this process. And we'll be doing this over the next 6 to 8 months, and engaging both the downtown community and the public as a whole. And this is an agreement to share the costs and the management of this at one-third each for a total of $225,000. So the next steps, as I mentioned, the surplus process, if we do want to move forward surplusing the CTC parcels, a motion to establish these public hearing would need to be made, and also we would have to I published the notice in the paper. Actually, two different notices. One's a press release and one's an actual print advertisement. We would come on December 3rd and conduct the surplus hearing and then have a resolution to approve all the remaining transactions for the property. We would continue on our feasibility work through the due diligence process, as every sale of property has a feasibility period to make sure everything you expected is there and it works for all of our needs. That includes the environmental, the cultural, geotechnical, and all of these are well underway. In fact, we have reports on several of these areas already, so we're doing very well there. And then finally, we would close the transactions right now, slated prior to January 31st, but we have the ability to move that out to February 28th under the agreement. So with that, it's kind of a summary of all the things that would be on that resolution, and then if there's any questions.
I'd like to add two things to the presentation, if I could. First, I want to be clear that this is not the decision to move. This is an option that's created. A decision on whether to move or not is one that's reserved for the board that will be made sometime in 2019 as we better understand this. Remember, we started with a strategic plan, and what we've been trying to do is work through to find out whether the numbers that we included in that strategic plan are accurate. And I will just say that, first of all, the purchase of the property is within the boundary conditions of what we set when we put the strategic plan together. So we feel comfortable that at least it's another step worth taking. But we still have more work to do before we would understand whether this is the right long-term decision for us. The second thing I always feel like we need to clarify is the Horan property is not the same as the Horan house. So just to make sure that there's no doubt in anyone's mind that there's a separate discussion about the Horan house and the property that the Horan house sits on.
That was actually, I was going to point that out in this. It's the very outside the red line, right outside the red line is where the actual Horan house sits there, on the just down by the river. And that's in private ownership, not the port's.
A lot of work.
It is.
We've talked about this now for many, many months. I won't say many years, but it's
it's really been going on. Obviously, the strategic planning process started over 3 years ago. So this is quite a bit of work, and keeping moving forward is great. This was something that we wanted to preserve the ability to move should we make that decision. And this is really the property that makes the most sense for our customer owners, for the way we deliver service. There really wasn't a great second option. And so to preserve that ability is really tremendous.
So are you looking for that motion at this time?
So, yes, if the board wants to set that hearing, here's the proposed motion.
Mr. Chairman. Could just ask whether anyone wants to offer public comment.
Anyone? You did improve my vocabulary by one word.
Uh-oh.
Appurtenances.
Oh, appurtenances?
Appurtenances?
Did I misspell appurtenances?
No, I just, it was a specialized term. And, you know, being an old coach and social studies teacher, I had to look that up. So I get it.
Is that attachments?
You improved his vocabulary.
Yeah.
You did?
I was hoping I didn't challenge. Yeah, it's just all, there's a lot that goes with those generators, so we use a catch-all term like appurtenance.
Yeah. So it was defined as what comes with.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There you go.
Okay, I got it. So any further discussion or input before entertaining the motion?
Anybody from the city or the port?
Pete, please come on up.
I just wanted to thank Dan and Karen. And
name?
Pete Fraley, attorney for the Portage Lang County.
Very good. Thank you.
Not anymore. I just wanted to thank Dan and Karen and Vicki for all the hard work over the last couple of months. It was a significant effort. We were meeting on a weekly basis. Just wanted to say thank you. And the port will be doing a very similar presentation tomorrow at its commission.
Thank you.
I was planning to do this at some point, but I'll do it now. So we did come to this agreement on a term sheet and walked back and said, here's the schedule to get it done, having no idea how much work it was going to take, honestly. And it turned out to be a huge surprise. So to Dan and Karen and Vicki and to Pete, who put in a huge number of hours. I just want to say thank you, because despite the fact that the workload was much higher than what I anticipated, they still hit the schedule. And we really appreciate the fact that we've been able to get this done in a timely way.
Thank you.
That being said, is there a motion?
Mr. President, I would move that we set a public hearing to take comment on December 3, 2018 at 10 o'clock a.m. for the purpose of the proposed sale of Chelan County PUD Confluence Technology Center, CTC, condominium units LL1201 and related limited common elements, along with two generators, two cooling towers, and related appurtenances as a part of the intergovernmental disposition between Chelan County PUD and the Port of Chelan County, and directing staff to publish public notice as required by RCW 39.33.020.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. Motion is carried.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dan, please share our appreciation to the other members of your team for your hard work.
Yeah. And appreciation to everyone concerned. Very much.
Thanks, Dan.
Fees and charges update.
New director. All right. I want to invite Kathy Melton and Lindsay Bonds up. Kind of two parts to this. One is this is the annual fees and charges update. But we also, at the same time, are addressing some of the issues associated with upfront charges related to cryptocurrency mining. So you'll see a little bit more than what you're accustomed to seeing at this time of year.
Good morning, Commissioners. Kathy Melton, Customer Service Program Analyst.
Lindsay Mons, Business Manager and Customer Utilities.
So as Steve pointed out, it is that time for the annual review of fees and charges. These are the non-recurring one-time charges that our customers face. Today, the presentation is going to focus quite a bit on the electric side of the house. That's where most of our revisions are coming into play. Lindsay will cover the HDL and cryptocurrency elements. And just as a reminder, the authority to adjust these fees was delegated to the general manager. Of course, part of that is coming to you and giving you an opportunity to ask questions and get some further guidance on that. So the first section that we're going to look at is our service connection fees. And these fees are the average estimated costs that our customers face for new services or for increasing their existing services. The costs include the average estimated transformer, meter, labor cost, and then some additional materials. These were last updated in 2014. When we took a look at the fees that we have in place now, we're recommending a limited 10% increase to narrow the margin. We discovered that we were only collecting about 71% of our costs with that. And so this 10% incremental step will close that gap to about 77%.
I'm going to pause on that for a moment. So part of strategic planning next year will be a conversation about should growth pay for growth. And I think as we prepare for that, we're looking at some of these kinds of things and recognizing that currently we are not fully recovering costs of service connections. We take a step in that direction, but how far we go will really be dependent on the conversation next year in strategic planning.
And then we also have an increase for our secondary service poles. So old fee was $650, and we'll be increasing to $750 to cover cost. And then back in September, you may remember Katie Marshall was here. She's our pole contact manager, and she went through the pole contact fee presentation with you at this time. So this will just be recognizing that $23.14 interim fee being added to the fees and charges schedule effective January 1st, 2019. Okay. Do you want me to do this one?
Sure.
I couldn't remember. Okay. So when going back and doing some lessons learned since the inception of the rate 35 in January 1 of 2017, we've discovered that probably one of the most challenging elements of dealing with the applications associated with that is getting enough and clear information from the applicants so that our engineers can actually begin processing those applications. And that was work that was not anticipated with the original design of the application and engineering fees. So we're proposing to separate this out into a two-stepped approach. Applicants would pay the pre-design fee. And then what they would get from that is a conceptual design, an opportunity for our engineers to work with them closer to get some information in order to move on to the next phase. If they did want to move on to that next phase, they would pay the engineering fee. And then from that point on, it would just follow the existing line extension process as it is today. Get the estimate and then move on with scheduling of construction upon payment of those fees.
Question I have.
Sure.
Excuse me. Is when I look at the range pre-design on the left-hand side, 1,000 to 5,000, you know, and similar. So is the size of the equipment, the wiring, et cetera, the same at 1,000 as it is at 5,000? Or the cost less toward one end of that scale or more toward the other end?
They would be relatively the same. Yeah, what we're going to be doing is on those applications or those installations, they would mostly all be primary metered at that point.
Okay.
So it would be much more similar. And we also have those additional studies that come into play based on the size of the service request as well. So that would include the system engineering, system impact, and things like that. So it is all relative to the size of the request and then the equipment that they would need in addition to that.
In addition to it.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now I'll talk about upfront costs here. So we've been talking about this extensively through the cryptocurrency rate and moratorium discussions that we've been having for the last 8 months. But technically, the upfront charges do reside in our fees and charges schedule. So they're not considered a rate because they are a one-time fee for our customers. So that's why you see them here today with the fees and charges update. So just another look at what we've done. So on the distribution side of things is where this slide focused. And as we've discussed before, we're proposing increasing the distribution portion of the upfront charge to $270 a kW. We took two steps in getting to this recommendation. First, we reviewed the calculation itself that we'd put together during the last moratorium process to validate that calculation itself to ensure that when we take a look at current costs and current substations, that it's still calculating the way we expect it to, and found that calculation to be within 1% of what we'd calculated last time. So we are comfortable going forward with that and with the current costs of our substation estimates in places like Chelan and Leavenworth. And this includes things like the land, the excavation, the construction of the station itself, all the equipment, connection to the transmission, but does not include the elements particular to Chelan and Leavenworth of high expense in the siting and outreach. So we did exclude those from this as kind of a one-off in that situation. After validating that calculation, we looked at some of the other assumptions that we'd made associated with it. And one of them was the assumption that the usable capacity of each substation is 100%, so that we could use on a regular ongoing basis a full 28 megawatts of a substation, and found that to be a little bit of an aggressive assumption. Our engineering guidelines and the way we operate our system would be to a maximum of 80%. We do operate on more of a temporary nature above 80% while we're building our next stations and then are able to offload those stations and whatnot. So really the portion of a station that we collect revenue on is about 80%. So using that new assumption within this cost is what increased it from $190 to $270, not because our stations are necessarily costing more. On the transmission side of things, this is a new portion of the upfront charges. When we went through the process last time, we didn't anticipate having enough interest in the rate to impact our transmission system, but now we're finding that's not the case because of the increased interest earlier this year. So we've identified two different charges for the transmission portion. One would be for any connections in the Wenatchee corridor, which we're considering anywhere from Monitor Old Station area down through Malaga. That would be $55 a kW, and that would support a project, a $5.5 million project to increase the capacity in that area by 100 megawatts. And then in the areas north and west of kind of the Wenatchee corridor, those areas are weaker in our transmission system and would require a substantial rebuild of existing infrastructure, not just an addition as in Wenatchee. So in those areas, our engineering estimates were around $450 a kW. And we've talked quite a bit before about our transmission lines kind of northwest of Leavenworth being old and very costly and prohibitive in property and ability to reconstruct. And so for this particular purpose in the upfront charges, we've not calculated a cost in that area and would not at this time connect any HDL or cryptocurrency. So this slide, just in summary, when you add the transmission and distribution charges together in the Wenatchee corridor, it would be $325 a kW. And $720 per kW in the other areas where our capacity is more limited. As was before, connections over 5 megawatts would be evaluated individually and assessed at cost, maybe more or less than these charges. So
I think you're up. Okay, so with that, the revisions that we've discussed today would be effective January 1. And some next steps include finalizing that pre-application, pre-design, the forms and the processes associated with that. Of course, I'm recognizing that we're still within a moratorium, so we're not officially accepting any of those applications at this time, but we would continue to refine those processes in advance of that. And then, of course, there will be some subsequent line extension policy for the electric side of the house. Updates that you'll be seeing will return to you with a resolution seeking approval of those at a later date.
Questions?
Hearing none. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate
it very much. Advanced metering.
And John Stoll and Mark O'Brien come up. We've been doing a ton of work here trying to get us ready for this next step.
Good morning, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. With me is Mark O'Brien, Customer Utilities Technical Project Manager. You may recall, it was about a year ago, we were before the board to seek approval to move forward with an RFP development. At that point in time, we were still kind of finalizing our customer information system approach. Mark had come on board, and part of his role was then to take over this aspect of the RFP. This certainly hasn't been just a customer utilities group, and you'll hear some more of this to kind of get to this point in development of a request for proposal around the automated metering. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mark.
Thanks, John, and good afternoon, Commissioners. Just a quick overview of kind of what we're going to cover today. Just going to give you a quick the purpose why we're here. Focus on the background of the efforts that have gone forth related to the AMI or advanced meter reading infrastructure. Look at some of the recent activities since we last spoke with you, and then identify those next steps, and then obviously any questions you may have. So the primary purpose here is really just provide you that background on the request for proposals that we're going to be seeking, authorizing staff to actually publish notice inviting sealed proposals for advanced metering infrastructure. Again, this is a conjunction with our current project of implementing Oracle's C2M product, which is a customer information system and a meter data management system, which part of your direction led us to select that option in advance of this project, the advanced metering, which relies on a meter data management system to fully leverage the capabilities of that system. So that's the purpose. These next couple slides is really just a review of some previous communications that we've provided to the board. This effort goes back to 05. It was put on the back burner, I think, about in 08 when an economic downturn occurred. But it has continued to be reviewed and evaluated. District staff have been monitoring technology advancements, have been doing research, have been reviewing best practices, have done site visits. We've actually put forth an AMR system, which is really automated meter reading system, which is a one-way type of metering system in our water system. So that was fully completed, and that was back, I think, 06, 07. And so that's our drive-by system. We have, at that point in time, we also established metering service contracts with the anticipation of going forth with an AMI solution and actually adjust our metering positions from 13 to 2. So that was all done probably several years ago at this point. Also, transitioned to a kind of a drive-by one-way meter device on the electric system. Currently, over 16,000 of our metered services have that connection. That's the new standard that we install with any newer meters or any meter replacements. We actually went out and sought expertise on this effort as well. So we have UtiliWorks, who is the our key consulting support entity that's helped us through the evaluation process and is currently helping us through the RFP development. We've presented business cases back in 15. Those were then updated in 17 prior to the last resolution the board approved. Again, spent a lot of time researching literature related to health and privacy impacts. Also identified that as part of that last resolution, the district committed to offering an opt-out option once we do implement and install a solution going forward. The next slide looks at what has really occurred since we were last in front of the board back at the end of 17, which the board approved a resolution really for us to move forward on the development and RFP. So since then, we finalized the selection of our billing system, and that's currently being implemented. We're about 8 months into an 18-month project, and that's all on schedule. We've extended the engagement with UtiliWorks to further help us with development of our request for proposals. Now, we put together an internal team. Again, this impacts a lot of different departments in the district, and so there's a pretty broad cross-functional team that's been working on defining what requirements, what kind of capabilities we want to have in place when we do select this this solution. we have currently we're looking at finalizing the language, and so we've gone through identified requirements, capabilities, as I said, but now just going through all the language of the contracts, finalizing those, and we're hoping to get that finalized by the end of this year. That's kind of the background where we've been, what we're currently working on. Going forward, we're looking to come back to the board on December 3rd to request board approval to actually issue the RFP. The district has an existing resolution that requires us to get board approval if we anticipate that RFP to exceed $3 million, and we do expect that project to exceed $3 million. So that will drive us to come back to finalize the approval of that, issuing that RFP. The plan is to issue that in Q1, most likely in January, but looking, we'll be discussing the actual timing of that with our consulting partners, making sure it's good timing for people to respond. That'll be out for several months as people develop responses. That's a pretty thorough RFP, and it will require some work from vendors to submit a complete response for us. We'd be looking to review those responses, evaluate those, determine a preferred proposal in that Q2, Q3 time frame for next year. As a side note, we're currently scheduled to go live with our billing system at the end of Q3. And so as that system goes live, we're hoping to have a selection made in advance of that, and then be looking to negotiate a contract with a preferred vendor toward the end of next year, Q3, Q4. Key thing that I would note is that in conjunction with approving that contract, we'll also be looking at what options exist related to the opt-out based on their solution, and we'll be looking to provide recommendations and also proving what that policy would be in conjunction with moving forward with that particular vendor. First couple of phases of that project will be kind of proof of concept, and so those could hopefully occur starting in 19, but at least by Q1 we're hoping to have some proof of concept, which in our RFP, we're proposing kind of two phases. One is kind of on-site, kind of more of a meter bench testing of the system, and that would be just, you know, a couple dozen meters. The second phase of that, and that would also include all the connections related to the communications, the head-in system, all the interconnections with the other systems as far as the communication with that two-way system. The second phase of the project would be a deployed number of meters, probably 300 to 500 meters, that would be spread throughout the county in multiple locations, really to test the overarching collection of all the meter reads and being able to control those remotely. So that would require all the associated infrastructure, the backhaul of that communication, the connection to the head-in system here at the district. Once those would probably last, you know, 3 to 9 months, depending upon the proposal that we get. And then we would be looking to fully deploy by 2020. We have requested that our deployment be targeting more of an 18-month window, but it'd be 18 to 24 months is what we're expecting to fully implement that system. And that's primarily going to be just putting all the meters in, because part of the proof of concept will be putting most of the backhaul communication devices in the system. So that's kind of an overview of upcoming steps. And with that, I just open it up for any questions you may have. One thing I like to add, I think I skipped over it, but the solution that we're looking for, we have spent a lot of effort looking at all of the technologies that would be enabled by an AMI solution, outage management systems, device control systems. But there's a whole long list of things that this system may provide to some extent, but other systems will be enabled to provide, you know, increased value to the district. In addition to those things, we've spent a lot of time looking on the security side of things. And so a lot of the requirements that we have in our RFP is to ensure that the system is secure and remove any of those concerns on privacy. As well as a key focus on ensuring that we do have options related to the opt-out policy. So that's kind of driving the backing of this whole RFP process. Commissioner Congdon.
Yeah. Could you put together just a bullet list for us of all the, trying to remember how you put it, all the benefits, all the added benefits for all the other systems of the AMI system? How'd you put that?
That's a good point. I'll identify two things. One is I did include some appendix sections in this presentation that do address those benefits to the customer, in particular benefits to the district, which would be efficiency gains or other added value items. So those are listed there. I would also note that the district has a standalone website that's off our main page related to the advanced meter reading system. And so that has documentation of all the customer contacts, all the meetings, all of our responses, as well as this content, which goes into detail on the anticipated benefits of the system, both for the customer and directly for the district operations. So take a look at those additional slides, and if they have additional questions, I can come back and add to those.
Okay. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. So this looks good. security concerns, the added security, could you detail that for us? I don't see that here. Just the general statement that you...
Right. So in working with, in particular, our cybersecurity group within the district, we've identified an entire section, which includes the recently identified questionnaire that was developed from the cybersecurity team, which is submitted with all envisioned interactions with other consultants, other projects. So in addition to that, there's all kinds of specific protocols that are going to be required to enable that secure environment. And so I can provide additional, there's actually quite a bit of content. And so it's many pages of content and details that we'll be asking people to respond to. I can forward that information to you. I'm not sure.
Boil it down. Well, yeah, just forward that to me. That'd be great.
Yeah,
and I'll work with it.
Okay.
Thank you.
And if you have additional questions, we can follow up.
Okay.
Any others?
I could just say thanks to this team. So you can see that AMI has to work very closely with a new customer information system, that a huge amount of effort is going in. You don't see this actually very much, but there is a huge effort inside the district trying to move us towards new customer information system that will be available in the fall of next year. And you also have to make it match up with the meter data management system, which is why we needed to be understanding the pathway for all three of these things as we're moving forward. So they've managed to keep customer information system moving forward and on schedule, and at the same time move forward with getting us ready for the RFP for AMI. And the piece you haven't seen yet is they're also working on a roadmap for how we will take advantage of AMI. So there's certain things we get right away. Obviously, meter reading becomes much more efficient right away. But things like how do you get to outage management and the option for prepay and some of those other things. So those are follow-on system work that has to be done. So they're working on a roadmap for that as well. They've really managed to keep a lot of balls in the air and keep it moving forward. So I want to say thank you to them for that.
There's a member of the public that wishes.
Please come on up and use the microphone. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Roberto Ocampo, local here from Wenatchee at 1244 South Mission. Checking this topic, I wasn't aware of it. And probably a good thing for you guys to review on security will be blockchain technology. There is a project on metering other kind of stuff, which will go to 10% of the cost that you are involving in here. Super interesting, and it's already been developed. Just guys, go ahead and take it. The super interesting solutions that are already there for meeting as well. That's all I'm saying.
Thank you.
Could you provide us some more information? Because that's not something that I'm familiar with. That maybe you could send us something that so we make sure we know what it is that you're referencing.
It's not that I have on me right now, but I can come over to at any point of time with a small presentation for you guys to review. But it's stuff that we use to meter like our own consumption for controlling the distribution. You guys can extend it. But also there are other technologies that are out there that I don't think that you guys are even aware of, maybe, in terms of the Oracle technology, which is AI related and neural learning for computers that are able to learn and kind of do a lot of management or administration process by itself. You start collecting, let's say I'm working on part of this technology on fruit commodities. So we record like 50 years of information of what the prices are, harvesting and chemicals they use or fertilizers. And then now the computer knows this information, we tell them, hey, what's the best price or what's the best scenario to grow this strawberry on this type of soil or blah, 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 blah. So the system installed, the computer give us the best scenario to start harvesting or planting. And those analysis are very far away if we do it like on a paper basis or a standard administration process. We let the computers do this AI and neural learning to help us make a better report or like decide which is the best scenario to go for. And I don't know if you guys catch what I'm saying.
I think I do. Let me just make sure I understand, though. Those are technologies for how you would interpret data. I don't think it's metering the electric usage, though. Is that correct?
Yeah, but I mean, there are technologies already out there to kind of go, like, if you go in a very simple process to meter ampacity in a bolt, you can transfer that into a Wi-Fi or some sort of a wireless technology, which is going to be way cheaper than it is, and then make sure those readings are encrypted based on a blockchain technology. There's no one can be able to either reinterpret that information without any credentials, that you are always hashing that information, but it's related to metering. And metering devices are like $9 now per hotline at up to 600 volts to 400 amps. I mean, you can just plug that into a reading device that is going to be Wi-Fi, which is $20 Wi-Fi transmitter, and then we can use 900 900 hertz frequency, which you can read up to 440 miles. I think, and the only thing on that portion is the security. Like, hey, everyone will be able to sniff into those packets, but if you use blockchain technology, then there is not information that they can be able to interpret. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So if you're able to get us something, if you got something in writing, that would really help us a lot, just to kind of understand where the options are as we go forward with the RFP. That'd be important to have.
Sure. I'll put some.
So you're primarily talking about the potential of using blockchain technology associated with our automatic metering.
Yeah.
And how about associated with cybersecurity? I've read a little bit about that in the Wall Street Journal, that there are cybersecurity outfits that are using blockchain more and more all the time. But that's all I know. That would be helpful.
Well, blockchain will behave just like an Excel spreadsheet kind of thing. The only thing is that you use special credentials to read or write to that spreadsheet. But it's like, that's the thing on blockchain. You can make your own spreadsheet and put those special instructions just to be able to handle by this specific algo behavior that is going to be changing every second. Or you already tell the system to send information, encrypt it, and the other side, there's already known how to decrypt the data and put it into that spreadsheet.
There's a blockchain group in town, and you're part of that group, aren't you? They came to one of our meetings.
This group are not developers. There are
Would they be helpful to us, though, in terms of how blockchain could?
Not that our group that you're referring.
No.
But there are another small group of people that are doing blockchain development. Not this group was just exploring the possibilities to find some solutions in terms of the fees and ratings, how to make a balance between here and there. But there are a couple other persons that I know, or individuals, something that are into developing, that will be very looking forward and helping you guys into working with this project that you are trying.
Could you share those names with us?
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
I mean, we meet every week, or
we're
local, and we're just going hanging out. We're a small group of people trying to do crypto here. There any other question?
Thank you.
Specific contact then, that'd be John.
Yes.
Yeah. I'll pass my information on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other thoughts or comments? Gentlemen, thanks.
I'm gonna ask John.
Oh. Yep, go ahead. I was just gonna
I was going to ask John if he could say we're going to jump into manager items so we can get a few things done. And he's got one, and he's also got a commitment this afternoon to meet with a customer. So I want to get him up here if he could.
Sure, I just have one. You've heard about this topic before. It comes out of the public power benefit. That was the regionalization study of the Upper Valley. We call it basically the Wenatchee watershed of regionalization. That was led by the city of Leavenworth to administer a contract with the FCS group, who does a lot of rate studies, things of that nature. You got the update, I believe it was last May. There was a little bit of back and forth over the summer just to kind of clean up the report, make sure the information was as up to date as possible. Didn't change the results of the study at all, but that group wanted to go out to the partners who were involved in that study, primarily City of Cashmere, City of Leavenworth, and the community of Peshastin, to see if and to present to those communities to see if there was any further questions or comments. So they concluded that Cashmere declined to have an update, but the city of Leavenworth as well as Peshastin did. So that concluded that public power engagement. So I would envision over December the last invoices would come in, which were clearly under budget, and then that again concludes that effort. Just wanted to make sure you were aware of that.
And I'll just add, John and I met with Peshastin. They were interested in pursuing a conversation about a possible merger with the PUD. So we've had an introductory conversation, I would call it. They provided us a lot of good information to think about. We said we would really need to think about two things. One is just the financials, and we want to dive into them some, see if they make sense. And the second is, what's the level of community support for this? We were clear that this is not an initiative that we need. We don't need growth to succeed as a not-for-profit. It's really only if the community is interested in having us essentially take over that system that we would be interested in pursuing it. So we'll have more conversations with them, and we'll see how that evolves as to whether there's something there worth pursuing.
Appreciated Ron Slaybaugh and other staff members who assisted with that. It was kind of a long, drawn-out process, and everybody put their best efforts to study it, get the data, and make good decisions. So I just appreciate their work.
Thank you. I'll pass that on.
Thanks, John. Thanks. Steve?
Got a second manager item I'd like to jump in of three. Kirk Hudson, John Seigers are here to provide you an update on the Powerhouse 2. Recall that we had a resolution about a month ago.
October 1st.
October 1st on the RFP. So they're going to give you an update on, we've learned some more since that, and want to let you know about it.
Yeah, Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission, with me, John Sagerser from Engineering and Project Management.
Good morning.
And we have been learning a lot on this design-build process, particularly as it relates to large hydro work. We did ask you to authorize advertisement for request for qualifications for the Powerhouse 2 modernization work. That was on October 1st, and since then, we've learned a lot more, and we've recognized and gotten some good advice from consultants we've been working with that we might want to include more than just the RFQ when we go out and advertise. And so we've weighed pros and cons, and John's going to provide some of the trade-offs that we're recognizing. And bottom line is we are going to delay slightly advertising for the RFQ to include more information to prospective proposals. John?
Thanks. Yeah, so if you remember, the design build selection process is a multi-step process. It begins with the request for qualifications, followed shortly after with the request for proposal, and then after that you make a selection and you negotiate a contract. What we've found, we went through a design build workshop that was put on by the General Contractors Association. And it was highly recommended in that workshop, as well as our consultants, that you include the request for proposal and the form of the contract with the request for qualifications when you advertise, which gives the contractor kind of a broader view of what the total project is and whether they've got the resources in-house even to respond to your request for proposal, as well as to actually do the project itself. So that was the advice that they were given. We checked with our consultants that we've hired, a design build company called Parametrics. We've also checked with our internal legal, Katie, and our external legal counsel. They recommend the same thing, that we include as much information as possible up front. A legal counsel was quick to point out that the contract is actually required in the RCW to accompany the request for qualifications. And I've since discovered that the design build contract is quite a bit different. It's a whole new contract than what we typically do through our procurement department. So right now we're in the process of finalizing the request for proposal, making sure that that's all buttoned up nice and neat, particularly the evaluation process, since part of this is we get to tell the proposers how it is that we're going to evaluate them, what criteria we're going to use. We need to be clear on that process. So we're including that information in there and then developing the whole new contract and making sure that meets our requirements. Specific language that we've already pre-negotiated, so to speak, with a lot of the big three hydro turbine generator manufacturers. There are many legal clauses, ownership of
intellectual property and how that's handled, indemnity, some of these types of things. We want to make sure that we've kind of pre-negotiated. We want to make sure that those find their way into the new contract as well. So that's some of what we've learned and some of the reasons why we're recommending delaying until we get those documents finalized.
Timeline-wise, correct me if I'm wrong, but we'd expect to be back either the very end of this year or the first part of 2019. That's correct. For the RFP. And, you know, I'd say just to put it in context, we're slowing down the request for qualifications, but we're moving up the RFP and contract, and we're getting that in a substantial form that we wouldn't have at this time if we just went out with the RFQ. So we're slowing down one piece and accelerating another piece. And the thing that's, this is a very unique project. You don't have a lot of people with pressurized bulb turbine experience. And so we want to make sure that we've got the best proposals that come with that. So we want to make sure we get this right.
And this is an entirely new contracting mechanism for us that we're trying out on a really big project. So it makes sense to try to make sure that we learn as we go and be prepared to modify our approach as we learn new things.
That sounds like a great approach. I mean, you're taking your time and taking measured steps and learning as you go. That can't do better than that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead. And Steve Wright has a staff recognition moment.
Yeah, I'd like to invite Suzanne Hartman to come up. So we do have a number of folks who leave the PUD, but there are a few who I know the board works with very closely, and certainly I've worked with very closely ever since I got here. And I want to just take a moment and recognize Suzanne and the tremendous job that she does. You all see the amazing number of awards that we get in the communication arena. They come in on a regular basis. In fact, they come in so regularly it might be easy to overlook them. It is unusual to get that number of awards, and it reflects the dedication and the spirit and the commitment to quality that Suzanne has exhibited ever since, at least ever since I've been here, and I'm sure long before that. But I just want to recognize for a moment the extraordinary hard work that she puts in. I mean, she just puts in a huge number of hours, not just doing our communications activities, but being out in the community on a regular basis for the events that we hold, putting them together and then being there for them and being vibrant and alive and being a great representative of the PUD at those events. In fact, when Tracy has been looking at someone as a replacement, I told him the number one thing you have to do is come up with somebody who works really hard. I'm not sure you could find somebody who works as hard as Suzanne, but you need somebody who works really hard, because you can do really great things when you're committed to delivering products. And Suzanne has just been amazing in that regard. So I want to take a moment and just say thank you to her for her dedication. And I believe November 30th is the date that...
November 30.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I'm I have every germ known to mankind and womankind, thanks to my 2-year-old grandson. So my voice is not the best, but I'm better than I was last week. So, but thank you. This has been a pure joy and a delight. 5.5 years has gone fast. Doesn't seem possible, but it's been wonderful. But you haven't seen the last of me. I'll be around.
Can we make comments?
I don't know.
We're going to miss you a lot. You know, you're right. We don't see everything, but we see a lot. We see a lot more than the public does. And I'm going to miss, I personally, your sense of humor with the squirrels that give their all in the power outages that we have seemed on a recurring and increasing basis. So that's just one item, but. I mean, those texts and emails can come all times of day or night, weekday, weekend.
Squirrels are particularly fond of Seahawks games.
Yeah. So, much appreciated from this commissioner. I just want you to know that.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that. Again, it's part of the job. So, And I have a great team, which that helps a lot, too. So we kind of get to share some of the responsibilities of outage patrol.
Well, Susanna, it's been a real pleasure working with you. And I think our loss might be the Land Trust's gain.
That's true.
You will still be in our community, and we'll still be running into you. And I understand that you'll be taking on occasional projects for the PUD.
I hope to. Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to continuing to see your smiling face here in the halls at the PUD.
I promise not to be a cranky customer. But thank you.
No, it's been a pleasure. Great.
And yes, starting in March, I will be going on as president of the Land Trust Board, which I'm really looking forward to. That I've been involved with that organization virtually since I got here. And I'm really looking forward to that activity. So,
well, they're really going to benefit from your talent.
Thank you.
Other thoughts?
Oh, wait a minute. What's this?
This is my pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. And I just simply echo all of the other comments. And remember our first conversation. And I walked out of that room going, spot on. We have our communications director that I've been looking for. Hasn't been a moment of disappointment, and I appreciate you and your efforts. Thank you.
And we're at time.
All right. So with that, we will recess and return at 1. For a public hearing, and then followed by a second public hearing regarding the budget. Until then, we're recessed. Good afternoon, excuse me, and welcome to the Cheyenne County Board of Directors November 19th, 2018 meeting. All five commissioners are here today. One will be here shortly, but we have a quorum currently. And we are starting out at 1 o'clock with a public hearing related to cryptocurrency rate and moratorium. And with that being said, let me turn it over to Steve Wright, our general manager. But before we do that, we encourage your participation today. And so when it's your opportunity to speak, we would encourage you to do so. But please come to the microphone, as our meetings are recorded for the general public. State your name, your address, and we'll give you a reasonable length of time, which would be approximately 4 minutes. And then what we'll do is if we cycle through and you would like the opportunity and we have time available, we can do a second bite of the apple and continue to give you that opportunity, but do it in the sense of fairness and equity. So with that being said, General Manager Steve Wright.
Just a reminder that we reviewed at the last board meeting a presentation that would be given at a public meeting that Lindsay and others conducted. So today we're going to come back and describe a little bit about that that meeting, and recall that our schedule at least calls for this being a public comment today and then moving toward adoption of a rate at the December 3rd board meeting. With that, I'll turn it over to Lindsay.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Lindsay Mons, Business Manager and Customer Utilities. Back here today to talk about cryptocurrency, both the rate and the moratorium. It's a dual hearing today to cover both topics, so we'll work through those today. We'll talk a bit about public outreach. So most recently, we had a public information meeting on the evening of November 7th. We've got some comments, reoccurring comments, basically what we've heard through the process, and we'll just cover those today. Talk about the proposed rate schedule, a moratorium approach, which would probably be the most new information today, and then next steps. We'll have a public comment period there kind of between the last two bullets. So just a brief summary here of the meetings to date. I'm actually not going to read through this slide, but really more of a visual to let you know what we've been doing for the last 8 months. It's 8 months to the day since the moratorium was implemented in March. And as mentioned, the most recent meeting was on November 7th, a public information meeting, well attended out at the CTC that evening. So the themes of public comment that we've received really through this process and reiterated again at that information meeting were kind of the first two together here, that the new rates would make existing operations uneconomic, as well as the second one where the new rate would drive away new business opportunity. And that is something that we've heard throughout the process and have tried to be responsive to as we've adjusted the rate accordingly in the ways that we could, while still looking for a rate that met the objective of ours, which was cost recovery for the rate group. There's been some concern expressed regarding the energy associated with the new cryptocurrency mining and the high volume of energy, that it would change our energy mix and make us less green. But the proposed rate schedule and our approach does contemplate that we would purchase green energy for any increased purchase needs that we have associated with this class. There's been opinion that there was not adequate opportunity for the public to inform the rate. As mentioned, over the last 8 months, we've had many meetings associated with this project. At all meetings of the board, as well as every day that we give presentation, is an opportunity for the public to engage in the process. We've had many public comment periods and discussions along the way. Countless media reports, digital media, printed media, everything associated. So we hope this doesn't come as a surprise to anyone that we are putting this rate or recommending a rate associated with the cryptocurrency class. Concern expressed that the rate is short-sighted and doesn't consider the economic benefits. In that area, I would note that we've been very involved reaching out to the city and county who do kind of drive the economic approach of the region. And the information or primary concern that we've gotten back from them is really concern associated with the increasing load, creating, restricting perhaps other growth that would need energy in the area. So that the large amounts of energy needed would leave non-cryptocurrency customers without the ability to connect new loads or expand existing. So we have reached out associated with economics in the way that we can. I think that effort does still continue those discussions as well. And then the last bullet here, we have also had some positive comments from the public throughout the process and recognition that it's been a thoughtful process by the board and staff. Consideration is that what is the best for the most for the longest has been a theme throughout, avoiding those cost shifting risks between classes, as well as our focus on safety and reliability associated with response to cryptocurrency mining. So with that, we do have our proposed rate schedule here printed in your materials. The proposed rate would be applicable to any cryptocurrency related data computing, data processing type loads, Bitcoin, blockchain, proof of work, or other loads having those similar characteristics as we see with the cryptocurrency mining. And for this particular rate schedule 36, the proposed rate would be a two-phase implementation, the first part being effective in April of 2019, and that would be an increase to the current Schedule 35, which is what cryptocurrency miners currently pay, an increase on the energy side to be reflective of the market price of that energy. Within this particular slide, you do see a minor change since we were here last, and that is an update again of the market energy rate, and we will see that number continue to move slightly as we move towards adoption. This was only a 0.02 cent increase, so very small, but it does change the numbers from what you've seen before. And then the second phase of the rate implementation would be effective in April of 2020. And that would be implementation of a residential demand charge, which is not currently in place. Included in Schedule 36 would be a demand exceedance fee. It would occur only in those situations where energy limit has been exceeded, and it's reflective and intended to cover the cost associated with administering the management of the contracts of the limits associated with various connections, what our engineers have determined to be safe and reliable at those particular services, and recognizing the degradation of equipment that occurs when those limits are exceeded. And that's a $150 fee per month that it occurs, plus a daily charge of 1.5 times the applicable demand rate associated with that particular customer. Schedule 36, these rates that I've discussed so far would apply to customers 3 megawatts and less. As we talked about last time, this 3 megawatt limit is an increase from what we've talked about before. In response to some of those public comments that we've heard associated with the previously proposed variable market rate, this more or less fixes that rate on an annual basis for up to 3 megawatt services. Anything over 3 megawatts would have a contract rate, which may also include that energy at the daily market rate, minimum demand charges, ancillary services, and other energy type products. So that covers the rate portion of what we were going to talk about today. And then on the moratorium side of things, we've had a moratorium since March on all cryptocurrency applications, both processing and accepting new applications. The recommendations from staff associated with the moratorium would be that when the rate is approved, which we've proposed to be in December, we would begin review of those existing applications that we have on file. And accept applications that are associated with account changes, so more administrative type applications versus new load. During this time, when we're doing that review, we would look for updated application materials from customers, kind of that confirmation that they still wish to proceed with the process. And as those engineering designs are completed, construction and connection would follow the payment of the engineering and estimated fees as per our normal process. Then the next step would be when the rate is effective, and at this point proposed to be in April, we would begin accepting new applications for new service. So kind of a two-phased moratorium recommendation there. So next steps following today would be a motion today to continue the moratorium until December 3rd, which is at the point we would request a consideration of a rate resolution associated with Schedule 36 cryptocurrency. And then other efforts between now and April, would be drafting new customer agreements for all of our cryptocurrency customers, as well as updating associated policy and regulation. So, if the board has any questions on that material, other than the moratorium, it shouldn't be anything new, or hopefully not surprising.
Any comments or questions from the board? To Lindsay?
So, commissioners, if I might, the only clarification I would put, and it's not a disagreement with Lindsay, is when she made the statement that this more or less fixes the rate below 3 megawatt service charge for the year. That's the intent of this, but I just want to make it clear it's not a guarantee that that rate would not change if something out of the ordinary or extraordinary occurred. The board always retains the ability to adjust its rates. It's designed to address the concern about, I'm going to say, variability and predictability in the rates, but I didn't want her comment to be taken as a guarantee that they would not change except on an annual basis.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Right. If there are no questions, I'll turn it over to you, Dennis.
All right. So we'll open the floor to public comment, and again, please use the microphone, name and address, and we'll give you 4 minutes, and then take a look at a second round should you have a desire to speak again. And please address your comments to the commission. It is a hearing, and the commission is the body that needs to do the receiving, to do the hearing. And it's really not appropriate to create a debate with one of the other people who is sharing their idea with the commission. So please direct your comments to the commission, and let's stay in that venue. So with that being said, microphone is open, and entertain input from any of the people who are here who would like to address the commission. So please do so. Somebody has to be first. Thank you. I was going to say, don't make this the shortest hearing on record. No, not at all.
Hi, guys. Tom O'Connell, 12049 Brett's Drive out in Leavenworth. Well, it's been a interesting last week or so. I'm not sure how many of you have checked Bitcoin prices or anything. We're at about 48 or 48.50 right now, so coming down pretty quick. It's a bloodbath out there. Ethereum hash rate has dropped to its lowest worldwide since February, and it's anticipated to keep coming down. We're probably going to see ETH. You know, there's no real support on it right now, so probably going to see that hash rate drop as more people throughout the world with expensive power are forced to turn off their systems. Chelan County is has so far been kind of immune to that. You know, we're able to keep working. Profits are scraping thin, especially on any kind of more legacy style hardware. But we're able to kind of drag by right now and get through these weak parts. If this new suggested rate went into effect, when say Grant County's is supposed to go into effect, we'd all be done for if the market didn't have a massive turnaround. I'm definitely appreciative of the time period that's suggested there, coming with an April change to the rate. But there's no guarantee that we're going to have a better market then. We could have, a worse market. So the suggested rate with the kilowatt demand fee and everything, unless you're running really cutting edge hardware, it's cutting it really close. For a lot of things, it's not going to work. A lot of people are invested in older hardware. We don't have the money to go out and buy new stuff with the current market. We're not making the revenue that we were last year. We're working with what we've got, and it's able to work here, but that's, most likely not going to be the case, and that's too bad. I feel like most of the other miners are seeing the writing on the wall, and if they're not looking at outside of this county sources for power, then I'd be kind of surprised. There's a lot of other options than Chelan County with the same rate or comparable, lower than the suggested rate, with contracts guaranteeing that for years. So really all this is going to do is just drive business out of the county. You're going to drive locals out of the county that are trying to, have the American dream here and work in their home and develop business here, but that's not going to happen. So, it's been fun while it's lasted. We're going to try and make this good until April. But, I guess thank you and thanks for the few years we've had. So it's too bad that we won't be able to continue operations here. But unless there's some massive turnaround, then, the business just won't be able to work. So thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
My name is Roberto Ocampo, 1244 Submission, here in Wenatchee. In the general concept, I think that PD, since they PD came over and put this moratorium, I think they're committed to some sort of agenda, because they never came into good pricing and terms. And for everyone to look at, I have a contract with Clear Water Power for $146,000 for a megawatt of power, already been connected and energized 3 days ago for $141,000. And that includes even the deposit. We pay for all the same thing we pay here, transformers, lines, piping, and all that stuff. 4.8 cents a kilowatt. 4.2, my bad. I wonder if you guys are pricing the right way. And if you guys approve these rates, I'm one of those guys that has an application request. I rather want to cancel if that isn't approved and try to get even my application fee money back before you guys do the study, because I'm seeing it ahead that is not going to be feasible at all for me. That's what I'm saying. Thank you.
Thank you, Roberto.
Thank you.
Jean Poyer, Cashmere, Washington. I just want to say big thank you to the board and to our PUD. I think you have been stellar in allowing public comment and input and sharing information on this subject. It's been a good learning curve, because if it wasn't Bitcoin miners using huge amounts of energy, it could be something else. So I think one of the things certainly that I've taken away from this is that low cost of power can be a blessing and a curse. Energy is precious. We need to become more resilient in our future, more sustainable. I'm not exactly aligned with the Bitcoin users, that massive amount of energy, but I understand that in the future there will be high density loads. And in that future, I appreciate that you have looked at transmissions out in more remote areas of the neighborhood and really done your best to discourage home use and wear and tear on the transmission lines and the infrastructure out in places like Leavenworth, Pishaston, and hopefully we'll continue to look at a more congruous, high-density load area that can be supported and maintained. This is not the way we want to have a fire in our area. So thank you very much. I think you've done an excellent job in information and giving us a chance to speak and getting the information out. So thank you.
Thank you, Jean. Was there a comment? Second comment? Please, Roberto.
Roberto Campo, 1244 submission here. are these rates going to be applicable for the people that are already mining or that already have Social 35? That hasn't been clear in the paperwork.
Yes. Yes, any cryptocurrency mining customers that are currently served on our Schedule 35 will be transitioned to Schedule 36 in April.
Which means I have to start getting prepared to cease contracts with leasing places and maybe the money that I'm paying for rent on these places has to be, you know, it's not going to come over to these landlords anymore. So if they are Schedule 36, at the current rates approved.
If there are no further comments from the public, are there comments from the board?
I believe I have a comment, but a proposed motion. I would move that in order to allow time for the board to consider the rate proposal to move and continue move to continue the moratorium and set the next public hearing for December 3, 2018 during the board's regular meeting and direct staff to prepare a rate resolution.
Is there a second to the motion?
I second the motion.
Been moved and seconded to allow time for the board to consider the rate proposal to move to continue the moratorium and set the next public hearing for December 3rd, 2018 during the board's regular meeting and direct staff to prepare a rate resolution. Is there further discussion?
Am I allowed to make comment in this period?
Yes, you are.
Okay. I just wanted to make it clear to the board that the motion on the table does conclude the public hearing associated with the rate today. And this motion continues the moratorium itself for the next meeting. It is, of course, the board's option if you wish to continue the rate hearing portion, but just awareness as to the intent behind staff's proposed motion.
Right. As I read it, just consider the rate proposal.
Yes.
Correct. It would close, have the effect of closing the public comment on this particular rate proposal, but it would continue the moratorium. Staff's current 39-page staff report in support of its rate recommendation will be made available next week in advance of the of the hearing on the 3rd. So you would be able to review it, and members of the public could come and review it as well.
Eric, share with us, please, the method in which the interested parties might be able to obtain a copy of that.
We'll post it.
We'll post it.
It'll be on the website.
So it'll be an online on the website.
Correct.
Thank you.
And available if anybody calls and asks for it.
We'll sir, please.
Share it with them.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I just have a very simple question. What means do we have to redress this report? I've not seen it.
Okay, please.
Bryce Greenfield, what means do we have to redress the report? I've not seen it. Shouldn't that be included in part of the public hearing section, or am I not understanding how this works?
So it's just staff's report in support of the recommendation. Certainly anyone could show up on the 3rd and argue in whatever capacity they desire for or against the adoption of staff's recommendation.
It's a public hearing.
It will still be the same format.
Yes. Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes, Steve.
Lindsay, on the April 2020 slide there, did I hear you mention the word residential? Is this what it's considered, a residential rate?
So in April of 2020, we will add the line kind of, let's see if I can show it here, in the middle, that adds a different demand charge for residential cryptocurrency mining. The rest of the rate is still applicable to all. It just separates the residential versus non-residential demand.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
If there's no further board comment on the proposed motion.
I'll make a comment, if I may. I just want to say thank you to Thomas and Roberto, and anyway, to the folks who have continued to attend meetings, have been very civil and polite. And I know this is probably a bit devastating for you. So, anyway, just my regards, and I wish you the best. Thanks for a very, very nice approach to this.
If there are no further comments, those in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried. And we'll move to item 10, which is another public hearing regarding our...
Could I add one other quick comment?
Yes, you may.
For the December 3rd hearing, we have a few actions that the board will that will be recommending that you take, including the Horan property and the budget adoption. But we're going to schedule those for the morning session. So I just wanted to make sure that the folks who are here, if they're planning to come, we'd like them to know that we'll be trying to deal with those in the 10 to 12 session, probably closer to 10 than to 12, just for awareness purposes.
So what do you anticipate?
You could make it clear that we'd start this one at 10. Is that what you're doing?
I think of the Haran one we said in this morning's motion would start at 10.
Yeah, so the way we handle that.
Close.
Yeah, so the way that we handle that is the way that we handled it today. We just set them all at 10, and then we take them in whatever order of priority the board wants.
Thank you.
And then we move at the closing of one hearing directly into the next hearing. The reason for that is it just avoids dead time in the agenda.
So the public understands that normally these hearings have been at 1. It'll be on December 3rd, and there will be more than one item related to a hearing. But we will start those at 10 o'clock, and we will take those in an order to be established. So probably in your best interest to be here at 10 or take a look at the agenda and gamble on your time frame.
That's what I was going to suggest. Yeah. We'll make sure that it reflects a 10 o'clock start time on the agenda that's publicly posted.
With that being said, item 10.
Yep.
Again, thanks to all of you, and I always appreciate the civil context in which your ideas and your interests have been displayed and shared, and much appreciation for that. And allow a little traffic movement, and then we'll take a look at our budget, please.
I'll just go ahead and invite Craig Koontz to come up to present the budget. Allow time to clear the room.
Residential. That's an interruptible. Do you remember anything about if it's going to be out in the resident or residence?
So item 10 on our agenda is a public hearing related to our 2019 preliminary budget presentation. Anything else that needs to be said in introduction?
Nope. Ready to go.
All right. Off we go.
Good afternoon, commissioners, and welcome to the second of two public hearings related to our 2019 budget. I'm Craig Koontz, manager of strategic financial planning, and with me is Deborah Vaughn, strategic financial planning analyst. So what we're going to cover today, we'll look at the timeline really quickly. Look at the changes we've made to the budget since the November 5th hearing, go through the budget summary, and look at next steps. I would note there's no board action required today. So this is a familiar slide we've shown every time we've presented. This is just kind of looking at the overall budget timeline. It's quite an effort. Really, we begin our process when we do our business plans back in September. And currently, we're at the second of two public hearings. And we'll be coming back on December 3rd to request formal budget adoption. And this is a slide from the November 5th presentation. We just really like it. This is just trying to put into context all the large work we got going on at the hydros and elsewhere in the district, looking at some of our top projects, both capital and O&M, the hydro work at the facilities and the modernization as far as the large unit repairs at Rocky Reach, the new substations, and our new CIS system. These are just kind of the highlights of a couple. But now looking at our changes since our November 5th budget presentation, not very significant changes at all. I would note that our capital spending has decreased from the November 5th presentation, net capital of about $2.8 million. And the primary driver there is some really Rock Island hydro work. And primarily, it's due to the fact that when we come up with the estimate for our budget, we also come up with a likeliness of completing that, managing all the work. And that was a 90% factor, and we adjusted that down to 85%, looking at all the resources we need to do. And so that's really the main driver of that adjustment. It's not a specific project. And so that was an expectation that we had going in, so that was not surprising. We also refined our contributions in aid of construction. That's the money we get from developers. And a lot of that has to do with refining our HDL and crypto work we're looking at as far as some work being done for HDL type work. We just add a little bit of contributions and aid there. And the other item I would note on capital we adjusted the total project cost for our operations and service center work to just look at the total preliminary estimates in regards to the property and design costs through 2019. So that's all we're planning on the total project cost for 2019. Another item that was refined was our net wholesale revenue forecast for our budget. As was communicated earlier in November, when we looked at the Rock Island schedules, those schedules for the modernization change, and with that changes our outage schedule. And with those outage schedules, those impact our generation ability, and that in turn had a negative impact on our net wholesale revenue of about $1.6 million. That reduction is more driven by the fact that we're going to have a little bit less generation forecasted to sell in the market than really price. But those have been updated and refined. We also refined our O&M plans, and that was an increase of about $300,000 of operating expenses. And that was just really an allocation of resources between capital projects and O&M projects. As they looked at that a little bit closer, they made a couple of minor tweaks, about $300,000. And then finally, a big item, well, not relatively small item really, but a big adjustment to comparison for November 5th was, as we look at our capital plans for 2018 and what we think we're going to get accomplished, we had to adjust what those assets would be placed in service, less than what we were thinking. So the depreciation expense for that year is lower than what we thought we would have. So when we look at all those changes, what affects the bottom line compared to what we communicated on November 5th, we have a reduction of about $0.9 million. So the operating revenues are reduced by $1.6 million. That's the net wholesale revenue I discussed. The operating expenses, there's that net reduction, the $300,000 increase in operating expenses and a $900,000 reduction in the depreciation expense, which is a net of $600,000. And then as we refined our contributions and aid, that's about a 0.5 decrease in that net expense. So bottom line changes from what we communicated earlier is about $0.9 million. So if we look at our combined financial results for our preliminary 2019 budget compared to our 2018 budget, I won't spend a lot of time in here. It's very little change from our last presentation. We do show that we're about over $5 million better than last year's bottom line when we adopted our budget. And you can see that $0.9 million change roughly from our November 5th presentation. And we were a little bit less than about $2 million less than what we were having in our business plans that were presented on October 1st. Looking at our capital expenditures, again, not a lot of changes from the November 5th presentation. I would note that Rock Island is the main change. That's still at about $72 million, so it's still pretty significant investment in those assets. And then I would note that the capital contributions are up for those adjustments we've made for the capital contributions. So our net capital is now at $150.3 million. November 5th presentation was $153 million. That's that $2.8 million I was talking about is that net reduction. And it's still pretty consistent with our business planning presentation with $153.8 million. So everything's been relatively consistent. It's just been refinements in regards to our resource allocation and timing of the work being done. And this is just reviewing the total capital project revisions. Again, every year we ask for approval of not only the current budget, but the total project budget. And this is very similar to the November 5th presentation. I just would highlight, again, the operations and service centers is just focusing on the 2019 expectations for the preliminary design work and the acquisition of property. And these are the new projects we envision taking place in 2019. So when we look at this all together, all of our operating expenses and our net debt and our capital expenses, pretty much in line with what we were presenting on November 5th, there is a slight reduction. The net debt reduction is the same as we were communicating on November 5th, looking at about $41 million of planned debt reduction of our existing debt, offset by about $2.5 million for the low-interest loan related to Shashan upgrade work. So, again, about $2 million reduction from the November 5th presentation. When we look at our combined financial policies related to our preliminary budget, everything is right on track and very consistent with what we presented on November 5th. And I would note the business line policies are included in the appendix if you want to look at those. There are no changes to those that we had in the November 5th presentation. So the next steps of our budget is really basically going to respond to any questions, concerns the commission has, is additional work and any information you want, and we will be coming to the board on December 3rd with the formal resolution adopting our 2019 budget. And there's a lot more information in the appendix, as I'm sure you've seen. So
yeah,
If you have any questions or comments on that, welcome to answer anything you have.
Commissioners?
Well, again, I appreciate the appendix. I like being able to take it home and, you know, on my own time sit and pour through it. And, yeah, that's great. I like the format very much.
It's good to hear. Thank you.
So I believe that concludes our public hearing on the 2019 preliminary budget. Unless there's additional public comment. Hearing none. Okay. Good. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
So we will move on to the consent agenda as amended with the published agenda plus adding resolution 14 and 15. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda as amended. Any discussion?
I just had one real quick. There's a there was a nice lesson learned on item 13, which is in there. This is the implementation of a new video surveillance system. We were moving from analog to digital, and the tricky part about that was it was a combination of software and hardware. So we have software procedures and hardware procedures for procurement. We had to put them together. Team did a nice job of finding a way to be able to do that and put us in a position of be able to deal with future contracts like that. So just wanted to share with you that we continue to perform the lessons learned on these issues, and that's one I think is particularly worth noting.
Appreciate it. Thank you. With that being said, those in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Consent agenda is approved as amended. Resolution 16.
This is a resolution ratifying field workers orders number 1 through 3 and approving field work order change order number 4 to contract number 16-81 with Rayfield Brothers Excavating Incorporated for unit price excavation services. Chamberlain's going to
provide. Hi there. Byrne Chamberlain. Engineering project manager, department manager. Bid 1681 was awarded based on estimated quantities for the bid price schedule for the first year of the contract. Prior to the bid and any yearly extension, expected work to be performed is discussed with district departments to determine bid quantities. The work in 2018 considerably exceeded the expected excavation unit quantities for this year, primarily due to performance of additional distribution reliability improvements in both the Chelan and Leavenworth outlying areas. This resolution requests the board to approve the second one-year extension as allowed by the contract and to increase the contract amount by $900,000 to a new not-to-exceed total of $1,773,000. So our lesson learned: this contract is available for use by all district departments. There's an approval process for authorizing the contract to initiate the work, but there is no formal internal process for authorizing each work assignment and tracking the total contract spend. This deficiency is now more important since the state lifted the $25,000 task limit for each task. New staff managing work in the field were unaware of the task limit guidelines, and work was performed that exceeded the current contract amount. So as part of this extension, a new process will be implemented. It requires the district engineer to complete an estimate of work for each task prior to contractor mobilization. The contractor has been directed not to start work until the estimate has been reviewed by EPM and PCS to confirm available funding. EPM will then issue notice to proceed via email. Any questions? Okay. That's the way we're doing it right now.
So, commissioners, if I might add to Vern's, this is
this is one of the contract types that we refer to as a unit price contract here at the district, and we have quite a number of them, actually. And you'll recall several years ago when we were working with the auditors and then later a legislative effort to get these kinds of contracts authorized for use by PUDs because of the value that they provide. One of the advantages that they provide, and we discussed it back then, was that we can make available to all areas of the district this type of work for unit prices that are actually bid and competitively priced, so that we can move quickly when we have the need without those prices that are often that often go along with emergency type services or work at the last minute when we're out there, and it's like calling a plumber on Sunday evening or something like that. So they're very valuable for us. But one of the challenges, and Vern has referenced it here, is that we kind of make a foreshadowed annual projected look at what kind of work we're going to need, and we set typically not to exceed for the work for that year in the contract documents with the contractor. And we sometimes require more work than that in the year. And in this case, we did, and we received an invoice that put us above the value that we had established for the year. So in addition to correcting this and setting next year's targets in the resolution, one of the things that staff were looking at and assembled a team to do, when Vern's included in that, is get together and take a look at the best internal controls that we can put in place to make sure that we're managing these contracts with the best information that we have, the best predictions of cost, and then a process in place that hopefully will avoid us having to come back here into the future. So we've got quite a number of folk now, 7 or 8, I think, from all of the primarily impacted business units that are going to work on that effort, and we'll report back to you what we find, if that's appropriate, when we complete the effort.
Vern, I just want to say one thing, and that is thank you, Vern, for kind of getting your arms around this and during this interim period as we move forward, volunteering to keep track of all the work that's out there. And
I didn't volunteer.
Let me rephrase that. Thank you,
Thank
Bert,
you for being honest.
For doing that. Sure. Appreciate it. Okay.
Yeah. Any other comments? Vern, I think in terms of equity, I'd just like to say go Cougs.
That makes it all worth it.
All right, let's take a look at Resolution 17. Thank you, Vern.
Thanks, Vern. The resolution authorizing continuation of services under service agreement SA number 13-028 with Northwest Open Access Network, NOAANet, to provide network operations center services. Bob Shane.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, commissioners. I'm Bob Shane, Director of Network Operations. I'm here presenting on a resolution authorizing the continuation of network services under service agreement 13-028 with NOAANet, actually Northwest Open Access Network, known as NOAANet. The current contract expires on December 31st of this year. These services provide benefit for the district staff, our retail service providers, and customer owners, and are necessary to meet our operational needs and expectations. For example, just to name a few of those services, NOAANet provides first-line support for our service providers. They also provide 24/7/365 monitoring of our complete network. They do service provisioning of the ONTs, and they also provide troubleshooting for our service providers and their customers. This resolution is requesting board approval and authorization to spend up to an additional $84,000 while utilizing the current contract through June of 2019, so we're looking for a six-month extension. This will allow staff more time to develop, publish, evaluate, and award under the new request for proposal for similar services. If approved, the total not to exceed amount for the contract will be $1,208,549.88. Do I have any questions for me?
I have one. I guess I still don't quite understand the relationship. If we were members of NOAANet, we are not members. We're not paid members.
That's correct.
Correct? So if we were, paying members of NOAANet, what kind of services would we get? Would we have a reduction in prices or fees?
We had the service with NOAANet as members previously.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to go back and talk with them to see if we were members, if there'd be a reduction in pricing. Since we're not members, this is a quote. This is a service we have with them since 2013. So I'm going to say that we are members in 2013. So these rates were created at that time. So an extension of this is under the same contract terms and conditions, so they're favorable for us under those, even though we're not members now.
I'm just curious what the advantage, maybe you guys who are more involved with Waputo know, what's the advantage to being a member of NOAANet? Is it just something you do because it's more public power and it was originally formed by the public power utilities?
Gary's our telecom guy.
I would say that being a member of NOAANet has many benefits but also obligations. And one of the obligations is a shoulder of debt. And perhaps it's time as a board that we go back and revisit our appetite to shoulder any of the NOAANet debt. But
I'm not suggesting that.
No.
I was just curious. I'm not sure what the year was, but I know that we requested, while we were members, we were requesting a fairly basic just some basic financial statements, and we're not able to get them. They weren't forthcoming, and so then we dropped our membership to NOAANet. So I'm just curious.
That was the case. We were, I think, quite honestly, fearful of the financial exposure we had.
Yes, and I think at a not too distant in the past Waputo meeting for telecom, there was a request for some information on financials for NOAANet, which were never made available. So I think there's even currently a reluctance to address questions to the financial nature from NOAANet in a public forum.
As a minimal, I'll look back and see when this contract was initially put together, if we were members or not.
Okay.
At the time, that at least gives us a reference point.
Thanks, Bob.
Yeah, I think my memory is at the time the assessed risk exceeded any benefit of remaining as a member, and it was primarily financial. And I think there would be a second concern if we entertained, reestablishing a membership is the salary level of the primary leadership in the organization, in my opinion, is, I will say, beyond excessive. And shocking is what it is. Essentially, we pay no one that same level. So that'd have to be a consideration.
I think Mike Coleman has more information about NOAANet. He's not here, is he? Yeah.
Well, the good thing about
how about if we get you some background information? Yeah. I think that might be the best way to deal with this.
And this is an RFP process, so NOAANet, as any other qualified vendor, can bid on this contract. So good. We will get the best services for the best price
right.
for the district.
Perfect. Good.
Bob, a question for you. Are there other entities that are in this business that could potentially step forward?
Yes, there are.
There are. Okay. Thank you.
No further questions. We have Resolution 16 and 17 before us. Bob, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
I move approval of Resolution 16 and 17 as presented.
Second.
Been moved and seconded to accept Resolutions 16 and 17 as presented. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Do we have additional manager items?
We do. I'm going to invite Chad Bowman up. He's got couple items for us. The visual is ready if you want to go with that one first.
Sure, we can do RC first. Good morning, or good afternoon. I'm Chad Bohm, the Director of Transmission Compliance. I'm here today really to preview a resolution that we'll be bringing to the board on December 3rd and provide an opportunity to answer any questions you might have or give you a chance to think about some good questions for 2 weeks from now. Really, the reliability coordinator function in the Western Interconnection, as you probably know, has been in flux for the last year, year and a half. Peak reliability, the current reliability coordinator that covers the entire Western Interconnection, announced this past summer that they were going to cease operations at the end of 2019 for various reasons. And really, as a result of that, as you can see on the screen, there will be four reliability coordinators coming into play next year. BC Hydro will be their own reliability coordinator. Alberta Electric System Operator will be a reliability coordinator. Southwest Power Pool will be a reliability coordinator, primarily members of the former Mountain West Transmission Group. And then the California ISO will be a reliability coordinator for a lot of that green area that's shown. This map is really a non-binding RC footprint survey that the Western Electricity Coordinating Council did back in September of what those footprints might be. We're really looking to try to avoid seams issues, which cause operational coordination issues between reliability coordinators. The reliability coordinator itself is really the highest level of reliability function in the West, or in general in the NERC functional model, where we talk to the reliability coordinator at least once a day. They're overseeing everyone's operations to ensure they're operating reliably. And occasionally they will call us and ask us to change something that we're doing. The RC transition is seen by a lot of the regulators, WEC, NERC, and FERC, as one of the highest reliability challenges that the West will face in 2019. And really, as we're making this transition, our recommendation is to go from peak reliability to the California ISO. I threw some costs up on the slide that you see. A lot of those costs, much like during the previous transition from the reliability coordinator when it was at WEC and when it went to peak, a lot of those costs are somewhat unknown until those potential customers sign up for service, which is expected to be done by the end of December.
So, who are the two brown spots on the southern group that's over on the west side?
Down here.
Up.
On the Columbia.
Portland.
Oh, those two. Those are most likely a wind-only balancing authority.
Oh, right, probably.
So, I just say, in the transmission reliability world, this is a really significant thing. And it's a big change, and there's a fair amount of concern. The new head of NERC, who used to be the head of WEC, has identified this as one of his half dozen highest priorities, is how will this transition take place, and will it effectively work? Because in the past, we've had one reliability coordinator for the entire interconnection, which I think the reliability folks would say is the best way to go. There's a lot of concerns about how you make the seams work when within an interconnection, all reliability is tied together. There is no real separation like the map would suggest that there is. So this will be certainly a high priority for us and a high priority for pretty much every utility in the West over the course of the next year.
Stay tuned.
Right. Just keeps changing. But at this point, really have, as we discussed this morning, we have limited choices. So when we bring the resolution next time around, we pretty much need to move in this direction. And Chad and his team have put together a good work plan for how we will get this done. There's a lot of work that comes with this. You got to create new systems in order to be able to connect up to the new reliability coordinator. So there's a big effort that Chad, his team, and it will filter through other parts of the organization have to take on this next year.
Questions? Thank you. I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Actually, you can stay because you got one more item.
That's right, one more item. I'd like to invite Mike Caputa up here, too, to join me if possible. Mike is the Director of Natural Resources at Chelan County, and we thought we would start. This is a video that Suzanne and the communications group made as part of an application for Outstanding Stewards of American Waters. It's an award that National Hydropower Association gives out once a year. So we thought we'd start with this video and then talk a little bit about the district's, what the district did for this, and really the overarching project, which Mike can provide.
Nason Creek is the highest priority for salmon recovery in the Wenatchee Basin. There's 300 or 400 acres of disconnected floodplain habitat, primarily from infrastructure. You've got Highway 2, the Chelan PUD power lines, the Bonneville power lines, the railroad. Usually we're just punching holes through infrastructure. This is the first one where we're really fully connecting the floodplain area. Everyone that was working on the early design realized that the bed was so low that you weren't going to get any true floodplain connection unless you were able to relocate the channel bed. After going through an alternatives analysis, we ended up choosing a design that moved the PUD power lines outside of the project area.
They had a goal they wanted to achieve, and we wanted to help them achieve that goal, but we still needed to maintain and operate the line. And so we worked with them in an iterative process of several different options to help facilitate what they wanted to do, but yet maintain our access. We ended up relocating a dozen poles, and it moved probably 200 to 300 yards out of the wetland and up to Upper White Pine Road. This line that we were working on is actually one of the original lines that was installed in the early 30s. And so we took some of that aging infrastructure and replaced it with upgraded steel poles that will be here and be serviceable for many, many more years.
I think the most significant part of this project is the fact that we're able to move infrastructure and truly reconnect almost 30 acres of floodplain habitat. Having those areas where there's slower velocity water and the fish can get in there and feed and rest is really important for their survival. That's really what we're trying to do here, both for fish and then it has human benefits as well.
The stewardship value at the PUD, it's top down and bottom up. Everybody in our day-to-day jobs, we all feel that responsibility to the local environment, our forests, our fish habitat.
I appreciated working with the PUD. I mean, you have to understand the time dedication to this project. We had monthly design team meetings for 8 years. It's a lot of time.
All in all, it was a win-win. We rebuilt part of our line with taller steel poles, so they're more weather resistant. The county got their project done, increased the fish habitat. It was a good project.
So before I get started, I really want to call out Steve Wickle and Jim Caldwell back there. They're really the ones that made that work up there happen. But we started talking to the county about this project in 2010, really moved through a couple different stages of agreements, and really reached this spot where doing this project provided a reliability gain for our customers. And that it increases reliability, it improves infrastructure by replacing wood poles with steel poles, which is typically what we do, and we replace structures and poles. And for the most part, the construction was grant funded, right? So the customers made whole throughout the process. And it's really, at least in my experience, the first time we've done something of this magnitude to improve habitat and fish, and at the same time improve reliability and maintain the financial, you know, the district customers remaining financially whole. So Mike's here. Mike was a really good partner on this project. Now he's got a lot of probably higher level perspective about why this project was so good for the fish and our stewardship obligations.
Yeah, thanks, Chad, and good afternoon, everybody. great to be here. So we did it. I think we gave you a couple of updates about this project over the last 3 or 4 years. It took about 8 years. Some of that complexity, though, is not just with moving your critical infrastructure, but part of the project is within Burlington Northern Santa Fe right away, and it's all on Forest Service property as well. You have an easement through Forest Service land.
Surprised it only took 8 years.
Yeah. So we got there. I'd like to acknowledge Jim and then Jennifer and our staff. I mean, those guys did the work and made this happen, and all the other partners who got us there. It's a hard place to work. It's the most important place to work for salmon recovery in the Wenatchee Basin in terms of restoration projects. There's just a lot of really important infrastructure there between the railroad line, the BPA lines, your lines, the highway, right? So there's a complicated place to work. And, you know, our goal collectively is to improve the environment and keep everybody whole. And we were able to do that with this project. It was not always easy. Right. I mean, working through these things, and I think we could always fall back on the strength of our relationship when things got hard, because things did get hard from time to time. We were able to work through that and overcome it, and here we are today talking about a success story and thinking about submitting for awards for this project. It's a really cool project, and we're able to work together to make that happen. So I want to, again, extend my thanks to Chad and others for making this happen, and I think we can say we look forward to doing it again, right? Or not. Yeah, I don't know.
Suzanne and I were up there maybe a month ago. Really, I hadn't been up there maybe once or twice during construction. It's mostly done, and it's absolutely gorgeous up there. So
I just want to say that's amazing. Congratulations. That's collaboration at its very best. That's really exciting. Good job.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mike, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for your time.
And I don't know if I said welcome, but we're glad you're here.
I feel very welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, great project, and appreciate everybody involved.
If we wanted to go look at it, where's our jump-off point as we drive up to
White Pine Road?
Yeah, it's White Pine Road. So you're starting to climb up.
Where the knife shop is.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Just past the knife
right there.
Shop.
Got it.
And we'd be happy to have folks take you out there too, because we can show you easier places to get in there. So
okay.
Anytime anybody would like to go take a visit, we'd be happy to staff that.
You know, before I was a commissioner, I participated in one of your hearings during the early years of the project. And then to go up there after hearing how much infrastructure is there and then to actually see it was just shocking to me. I've driven through there probably 100 times, and then to stop and really look at it just blew me away. So I, along with Ann, I think that's a great project that should get some awards.
Great. Thank
it's
you.
A model. Yeah.
Anytime we have happy fish and people at the same time, it's a really good thing.
Yeah.
Thanks to the county for some great leadership on this too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Much appreciated.
Thanks.
Thank
All
you.
Right. Have a good day.
And it was grant funded too.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Next up, you may have noticed that Rob Davis slipped in and Fred took Eric's place here. Eric had to make a phone call, but it turns out that we also have an item that Rob wants to update on relative to BPA transmission rates and a settlement that is nearby.
Yes. So, Rob Davis, staff attorney. Glad to see everybody again. BPA has been hosting some workshops over the past year, maybe even year and a half, looking at updating their transmission tariff. They've done this in the past, but usually it culminates with a proposal they take to FERC and get FERC approval that it's consistent with what FERC requires jurisdictional utilities to file. BPA has decided they don't want to go that route anymore because of some changes FERC has made that they're not willing to adopt. But the wrinkle for them is they have a provision in their tariff which says they have to go to FERC to make any changes. So the first thing they want to do is get rid of that so they can begin running their own process for future updates. We have a transmission contract with them for the Nine Canyon facility. We're pretty small relative to a lot of other transmission customers of theirs. But it also affects us because we're a transmission island and the giant ocean of Bonneville system. So having the ability to update this more frequently will be beneficial for us because it'll be beneficial for our long-term purchasers. So they are proposing a settlement agreement. As I understand it, there are no objections to it yet that they want to enter at the end of the month. If there were objections, they would go forward with a hearing in conjunction with their regularly scheduled rate hearings, put it before the hearing officer, reach a record of decision, possibly on the same timeline and probably reaching the same result as they're proposing to us in the settlement. But overall, it is beneficial to us. Like I said, the biggest benefit is they will now be able to make changes on their own without FERC approval. So we've been working with Bonneville for a while now. They are oversubscribed coming out of Mid-Sea. So on paper, there's not enough transmission. In fact, they've sold too much. Physically, the system can handle more customers, but they can't sell it while on paper they show they're oversubscribed. They've acknowledged this to us. They've tried to work with us, but they can't make the necessary changes without going back to FERC until they remove that provision. So that's going to be a good change for us. A couple smaller items that also affect us. Currently, BPA limits the price that their customers can resell their transmission for. So if a transmission customer is not using their transmission rights, wants to resell them, they are capped at BPA's transmission rate. So there's not really much of an incentive to resell. They're proposing to get rid of that cap, which could create a secondary market for transmission, which would give our potential purchasers another option for acquiring transmission. So also helpful to us. Third thing that affects us is the hourly firm transmission. This is probably a smaller impact, but don't have a full assessment on it. But currently, Bonneville sells unlimited hourly firm transmission. It's great for marketers trying to move out of Mid-Sea. They had proposed to get rid of it altogether because it's a non-standard product. They got a lot of pushback, so they're keeping the product, but they're going to really dial back how much they sell and how soon you can schedule it. So rather than 20 minutes before the hour, it's going to be in the pre-scheduled time frame. So at any rate, it's going to be less available than it was, but still available. So those are the big areas where we're impacted. On whole, we think it's going to be a good thing for us, especially because it just gives us more of an opportunity to work directly with them on things that impact our system. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them and provide any additional detail.
So since both FERC and BPA are going to be represented at WPUTA's annual meeting in a few weeks, are there any probing questions we should be asking? We do have a FERC commissioner coming to our PUD Association meeting. So
probably not relative to that.
Okay. I love stirring the pot sometimes.
Anything else? Rob, thank you. No good problem. To see you sitting in the chair.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Rob.
Thank you.
Got a few more things I want to cover. First of all, so the carbon tax did not pass, and one of our positions has been that we didn't think any legislation should move forward on carbon if the carbon tax did pass, because we thought it would take a huge amount of effort to just deal with that. With it not passing, there has been a big effort going on for months, governor's office, a variety of utilities, and the environmental organizations on developing a clean energy standard. So I just want to make sure that that's on your screen, that that is likely going to be a part of the debate in this next legislative session. There are some advantages to us. Clean energy standard does include hydro, so that's certainly preferable to a renewable portfolio standard expansion that does not include hydro. There are some fairly key, what might seem like arcane technical issues, but they are pretty important to us in terms of how it will impact the market that that we're engaging on. And a question about what happens if you don't meet the standard. And so at the end of the day, this tends to look like both a standard as well as a price on carbon in the electric sector alone, which I think tends to be more consistent with the perspective that we've had here, that could be good public policy. So we're engaged in that. Just wanted to put it on your screen that that's likely to be the big issue in the carbon front relative to electric utilities in this next session. So last week and, or I guess a while ago, in the last 2 weeks, I've done a lot of traveling. Among the meetings I had was with FERC Commissioner Cheryl LaFleur. We did get our early action language that was adopted in the Water Resources Bill and signed by the President. So what that means is now there's a new provision that FERC will have to interpret what it means relative to hydro relicensing. Remember, we've been bouncing back and forth. We got language included in an early bill. FERC responded by putting a policy statement out. Now the Congress has acted to actually adopt the language. It's not exactly consistent with the policy statement FERC put out, but we feel like it's good. So we now have to move to that next step of how will FERC implement the language. So we're starting the conversation with the FERC commissioners. I am aware of the FERC commissioner that's going to be at the WAPUTA meeting, and we'll be talking with him there actually about it as well. So just wanted to put it on your screen. We now have more work to do. This created we talked about this provision before, that it doesn't clearly decide the issue, but it creates an option that we did not have before, and we need to make sure that option is one that is most beneficial for our customers. So making some progress there. Then I would just say I spoke at an APPA conference last week, and it was an interesting conference. It was the Public Power Forward Summit that I think you went to an earlier version, Commissioner Arsenault, and I thought it was good on a lot of fronts. There were a lot of issues that were discussed, smart cities and a lot of sort of new technology kinds of things, many of which struck me as being a bit far out there and not there in terms of creating a business case for customers. But the one that I would say I think we're going to end up spending a lot more time on in the next year or two is electric vehicles. Just the economics are getting a lot closer. An awful lot of investment being put in by the car companies, an awful lot of time being put in by public policymakers. And so I just put it on your screen that I think electric vehicles is an issue that's time has come in the electric industry, and we're going to need to think through how we deal with that, including our own rates and policies associated with EVs.
So another large 18 station going into Cleona. So, you know, it's huge.
Energy Northwest has a contract with the state and has worked with local utilities up and down I-90. And we'll be putting in a whole bunch of charging stations on the east side of the mountains on I-90 that is built around funding from the state, some funding from the utilities, rate commitments that the utilities are making as well. So, yeah, you're going to see more of those. And final thing. So APPA also has the DEED program, the R&D program that they run, and we've been looking at that for a little bit and are inclined to go ahead and engage. It's a less than $12,000 investment for the year to participate. A number of good programs have been run by other utilities around the country that we'll be looking at to try to take advantage of, and it gives you the opportunity to apply with your own innovative programs. And so we're likely going to be going down that path. That's it.
Okay. Commission items. Randy?
You bet. As we're all well aware, we had an election in the last month, and some local races changed certain aspects of what we're doing here locally. You're all aware that for the past 12 years, the Upper Valley PUD, port, and county commissioners have gotten together on a monthly basis for breakfast, and we have felt strongly about the value of that. And so As soon as the election results were confirmed, I reached out to our new county commissioner, Bob Boogert, and he's going to join us next week. But at the same time, we made a decision, and this is, I'm sort of throwing out a challenge to my fellow commissioners, to keep ex-commissioner Gaynor on our list as our state representative. And he has committed that when he's available, he would love to join us on a regular basis for breakfast. And it got me to thinking just in the last couple of days that we might be able to do that with our three elected state legislators, the two legislators and the senator, on an ongoing basis if we initiated that. I know, Gary, you've gotten a breakfast going with Commissioner Overbay and Commissioner Etherington. Senator Hawkins lives right across the river. Maybe reach out, and Commissioner Congdon, maybe with Representative Steele and Commissioner England, we might start looking at this a little more globally than just Tri-Commission, but including our state legislators. We're going to give it a try, and I'm pretty excited about it. And I think with legislative items that face the county and the PUD and the ports, might be a good marriage. So anyway, that's my commission item for today.
Okay, and I'll concur with that. It's been, I think, beneficial to be involved with the port and with Commissioner Overbay at those breakfast meetings once a month. And it just opens up some channels and the opportunity to, express and think in a little bit differentiated, setting than a formal environment. And it's been very positive. So I think that's a great suggestion. Other thoughts along that line? Any other commission items? Thank you. Follow up on delegation of items.
I have two. One of them will go into our parking lot, which is just that we're looking at when we'll get back to you on the B6, B9 vibration issues. Just want to note that we do have that one on the list, and just when we get more information. Second one, actually, I'd like to, if I could, even try to push to a conclusion today. So you had requested, the board generally had requested that we look into, following the paperless board presentation, the issue of whether the district could provide iPads. We do that in certain circumstances for employees, and so it is something that would be available to you as commissioners and certainly would advance the paperless boardroom. But I also want to just note that if it's district purchased property, then it comes back to the district at the end, and the risk associated with that is you want to be really certain that you're doing only incidental private business of any kind, because it all comes back to the district at the end. So anything you put on would be exposed in that regard. There's not a way that we could protect that. So we are prepared to move ahead, we think, given the interest that the board expressed at the last meeting, to say, yes, that would be an option that's available to you. And with that, would be moving ahead with the paperless boardroom generally as well. Just would like to confirm that with you, that that's where you want to be. Okay.
Is this an option available to us?
And
if we were to use this more restrictively, our own ones that we own?
Yes, you would you would be able to use your own as well, as I do. That allows you to then make sure that if you get a request, any kind of public records request, then you have to produce anything that's on your machine that goes there, but it's your machine, so it doesn't turn back into the district.
I just don't want to have two to deal with.
And that's the basic issue, is that you probably would end up with two. Yeah. You know, if you're going to have one of your own, then you're going to end up with two.
Mm-hmm. I think the other, Sue, thanks for answering the question on the iPad use for, so the level of flexibility for, say, a commissioner that wanted to use a Microsoft pad product would still be an option as
yes.
well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, that's the easier one for us.
Yeah.
Steve, can we maybe have a one-on-one to talk about the pros and cons of using your private device versus a district-owned device?
Yep.
Happy to do that. Might want to get Eric involved in that too, because he's probably thought about it more than I have in terms of the legal requirements. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to move ahead then.
Yes.
With paperless boardroom. And good. Okay. That's it for our
delegation of action items from today.
Got a couple. So first of all, there was a request to Mark O'Brien to provide the list of benefits that AMI will enable and a list of security requirements for AMI. Did the list of benefits in the appendix meet your needs?
Yes.
Okay. So we're just going to limit that to the security requirements for AMI.
Yes.
Then. And we're going to get back to you with respect to whether members of NOAANet get a differentiated price from non-members of NOAANet for providing network operation center services.
Can you tack onto that, Steve? Make the assumption that if you're a member of NOAANet, what are the obligations of being a NOAANet member, financial or otherwise?
Okay.
Thank you.
Got it.
I'd ask for additional public comments, but no one remaining from the public. Matters of general business. I'm before the commission.
Can I ask one question? After the presentation by Lindsay on the rates for cryptocurrency, I still have a question about the residential, and if someone goes into that, is that interruptible? And maybe somebody could, maybe I could just meet, ask somebody some questions about that before the next, for our next meeting.
Yeah, let's do it that way.
Okay.
So simple answer is we can still negotiate on those kinds of things. And in fact, are looking at that with one cryptocurrency miner now.
But it'd be a by contract negotiated. I got it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think you just answered my question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on, the executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 42.30.1101I to consider information regarding the infrastructure and security of computer and telecommunications network security and service recovery plan, security risk assessments, and security test results, excuse me, to the extent that they identify specific system vulnerabilities pursuant to RCW 42.30.1111A II, and to consider the selection of a site or acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase when public knowledge of such consideration would cause the likelihood of an increased price as authorized by RCW 42.30.11.1101B. Duration?
60 minutes.
60 minutes. So we are approximately 2:30, so at 2:35, we'll come back into executive session with the hopes of being out and meeting the time deadline at 3:35. With that, let's take about a 6-minute recess. It is 3:25, and the Chelan County Board of Commissioners is returning from executive session where no decisions were made, no votes were taken. Without any further business coming before the commission, the meeting is adjourned. Is adjourned. Is adjourned. Is adjourned. Is adjourned.